Okay, Bob Benezzi is on his way, but we have clearly a majority. When Bob makes it, let's clearly show him as president at that point in time. Welcome to the Triumph Gulf Coast Board meeting. This is, I think, our third official meeting. And I know many of you have driven a long way away. I think we have some, and I also want to thank President Devin Stevenson of the college. Thank you, Devin. Are you here? Thank you very much for allowing us to invade your home here. We really appreciate it. It's very thoughtful. We have some state legislators that are here. Would you please stand? They're hiding, or they will be here. So if you could give me a heads up when they come in, we'll. And also Okaloosa County Commissioners, if there are any here, would you please stand? All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for allowing us to invade your county. We also have with us today Pete Antonaki. He is the new president of Enterprise Florida. Pete, welcome and thank you for coming. We really appreciate it. Yes, sir. I look forward to being a partner with you as time goes on. Susan, call the roll, please.
And that's a reminder to speak. You hit your button in front of you. Chair Bentz?
Here.
Mr. Benezzi, Mr. Connolly?
Here.
Dr. Dana?
Here.
Senator Gates?
Here.
Mr. Riggs?
Here.
Mr. Shove?
Here.
Quorum present, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have a quorum that's present and one on the way. We're going to have a presentation by Florida's Great Northwest on strategic planning, but before we get there, I sort of want to recap a little bit where we are. And pretty soon, as the day progresses, you'll find out where we hope to go. I will tell you we've abided by the sunshine laws because I have no clue what everybody thinks about where they want to go. Susan's done her best to get me up to speed. Same thing with our legal counsel. So anyway, have some thoughts, but I think it'll be a robust meeting. We had our first meeting in July. We got funded at the end of June. Roughly 3 weeks later, mid-July, we had our first board meeting. And at that meeting, we put together committees to hire CPAs and another committee to hire a lawyer. They did their job. And by the August meeting, we were able to bring legal counsel on board as well as two CPA firms. I see Morto Sullivan back there as part of the team, and David Tipton is part of the team. Scott Remington is the lead lawyer on our legal team, and he's been spending a lot of time on Triumph lately. Would that be an accurate statement? And part of I know there's a little frustration from time to time. The statutes that pertain to Triumph Gulf Coast are not the easiest ones in the world to interpret. That's the bad news. The good news is they're there, and I think we can live within the constraints. I'm not saying those are negative constraints. I'm saying they're complex. So sometimes it's not easy to give a quick, down-and-dirty answer to a question. But I think after Liz and Scott have been digging into statutes heavily since they were hired, I think we're getting a little better feel for what's here and what's going on. Since the August meeting, the Application Process Committee has met twice. We were hoping they could meet more, but there are other things called hurricanes that have caused some problems. But, hey, it's September, you know. It's Northwest Florida. It happens. So having said that, I'm really pleased with the work that the Application Process Committee has done, thanks to Chairman Dr. Pam Dana. And that kind of brings us to today's meeting. And at today's meeting, we have some a lot of things we want to cover, a lot of ground we want to cover. There'll certainly be time for public participation as we move forward. We have another meeting of the board in 30 days, I think November the 10th, November 8th, Friday. And that meeting is in Gulf County? Crawfordville. And then in December we meet in Bay County. So we've still got a lot of work to do to move forward. So having said that, members, are there any questions of me, Susan? Okay. You've all had a chance to review the minutes of the previous meeting in August. Are there questions? Is there a motion to approve them?
Second.
Gates moves and Dana seconds. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, show the motion passes. Now we're going to have Kim Wilms from Florida's Great Northwest talk a little bit about strategic planning and some of the things that you folks are doing. So you're recognized, Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Speaker.
Yes, sir.
Well, they're getting ready. May I just have a quick moment?
Sure.
Just to say that I think any of us who've read the papers, watched TV, know how important the restoration of power is. You look at what's happened in Puerto Rico and Texas and Louisiana. I don't know if you saw it, but it was buried in the newspapers today. It should have been on the front page that in the most recent hurricane storm that went through northwest Florida, even though it didn't cause a lot of damage, 38,000 homes were without power. Here's the good news, Mr. Speaker. In 24 hours, Gulf Power restored power to every single one of them.
Wow.
I think that's very important,
good.
Stan.
All right. Stan will pay you later. No. You did a great job. You did a super job. Not just in this one, but Tallahassee last year. You were the saving grace in Tallahassee and other communities around the state and around the southeast. So we're grateful to Gulf Power. And I'm proud to serve on the board. Having said that, Kim, you're recognized.
Thank you. I'm Kim Wilmes, Florida's Great Northwest. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about our regional strategy for economic transformation. What I'll cover today are three key areas. Talk about the regional strategy itself, the process that we went through, cover targeted industries. I know that was something that was a concern at the last board meeting, and then talk about the strategic focus areas within the strategic plan. So as we developed the strategic plan, the intent is to drive economic vitality and growth in the region. When we were developing the strategy, we had a vision of Northwest Florida for it to become a diverse and vibrant regional economy where Northwest Florida residents and businesses have a wealth of opportunities. And then we asked that big picture perspective of what do we need to do in order for us to achieve that from a big picture perspective. And we asked we had a lot of focus groups and sessions. And so we asked, what should we do? We got these five main guiding principles which help serve and develop the strategies and initiatives within. So we wanted to make sure that we had a sustainable and enduring economic base. We wanted to have diversified industries that had high-wage employment growth. We wanted to make sure that we could collaborate across the region so that we had greater alignment of our existing resources. We wanted to make sure that we improved the vitality of all areas and populations in the region. And we wanted to make sure that we strengthened beyond our traditional economic engines, such as the military and tourism. So the regional strategy we developed covers all 13 counties in Northwest Florida, our three major MSAs, and our rural communities. And the actual process itself started about 2 years ago. We compiled regional strategies from local, state, and existing strategies and plans. We also stood before you 2 years ago and presented what is economic transformation. And we also researched and looked at what other communities and regions have done in the form of a regional strategy. Just this past summer in 2016, we were awarded a grant in partnership with the UWF. We were able to hire a national consultant called TIP Strategies to guide us through the process and begin developing the actual strategy. We had several brainstorming sessions, focus groups, one-on-one interviews, 860 folks from across the region, business, educational, government. Stakeholders across the region gave input into the development of this strategy, and the result was a 100-page regional plan. And now, just this past year, at the beginning in February, we actually launched the regional strategy, and we ended up having a full room of supporters. We had five councils to start beginning to kind of interpret and digest that study and begin implementing the strategy. So just this past 6 month, just this past August, we had our 6 month celebration. Again, we had a full room. And what we heard during that was that there are conversations that are starting to happen all across Northwest Florida. People are looking to collaborate and looking to do the right thing to help our region grow. So where does this all fit? Where does the regional strategy all fit? We are essentially building our community competitiveness. We're at the beginning. And while we're doing this, we need to start telling our Northwest Florida story. We need to share and promote our assets. We've got to market to prospects and develop relationships with business prospects and site consultants, which will help us generate leads. Once we get to those leads, we are now in that competitive project process. So being able to submit a proposal and encourage companies to locate and look at considering locating here in Northwest Florida. Once those companies are here, we want to help them get up and running quickly. We also want to make sure we take care of our own that's already here, help our existing businesses expand, and we want to help them also export. That's another way to help multiply the economy here. So to help better illustrate how we can win in the competitive project process, I want to show this quick video that we produced. You can hit the mouse on the screen. There, Donnie. There you go.
This is Joe. Joe wants to expand his business. A lot of places across the globe look appealing, but we want Joe to expand in Northwest Florida. Why? Joe's business will bring better paying jobs to the area, and the businesses that follow him, like his suppliers, will bring even more. Workers will now have more money to spend, which will go back into the community to benefit everyone. As the community then continues to invest in regional economic development, it'll bring more businesses and more jobs, which continues the cycle and grows the economy even bigger and better. In order to be more competitive and get Joe here, Northwest Florida needs available buildings and project-ready sites, a skilled and trained workforce, and a team to show Joe what Northwest Florida has to offer. All of these are top priorities in the Northwest Florida Forward Initiative, a plan to diversify the economy and make Northwest Florida the best place for expanding businesses. With this initiative and the teamwork of communities across the region, we will build a brighter future for Northwest Florida.
So we want people like Joe to come and locate here in Northwest Florida. We want to attract and support the expansion of companies that are in these five targeted industries, primarily because they leverage what we already have here. They offer the greatest potential for sustainable and economic growth, and they will help generate new wealth into the region. These types of companies also fall into what the Brookings Institution categorizes as advanced industries, which are the industries that encompass the nation's best shot at supporting innovative and inclusive and sustainable growth. This does not mean that we need to ignore our existing industry that are not in the targeted sectors. We still want those existing companies to grow and succeed. But when we talk about targeting industries and what companies we want to come and locate and support the attraction and expansion, it's these companies because they can help exponentially grow and transform the region's economy. So what I'd like to do is talk about each of these targeted industries. I'll cover some national trends and then also some of the reasons why Northwest Florida is competitive in them. So first, let's take a look at manufacturing. There's a great report out there called The Flow of Money by Polycom, and it shows the impact of a manufacturing company here, a manufacturing company, and what it does to produce direct jobs and indirect jobs. Manufacturing should be a strong focus for Northwest Florida because they typically bring a large number of jobs. Now, we know that over time, manufacturers are becoming more productive, and so we may lose some of those jobs, but at the end of the day, they will still be a large number of jobs. They offer a full spectrum of jobs at every level. On average, the wages and the benefits are better. They're a multiplier of jobs, creating additional indirect jobs in the community, such as restaurants and healthcare. So in this example, you'll see that a 500 manufacturing jobs will create almost four times the number of jobs, indirect jobs in the community. So manufacturers can also export their products, which can provide exponential growth for the company and in turn for the community. Manufacturing is becoming more high-tech and has been steadily upskilling for the past two decades. And manufacturers overall, they stimulate the local economy. So our competitive advantage is that we are located within close proximity of some major automotive and aerospace OEMs, original equipment manufacturers. That provides, we've got saturated markets now in the southeast, which gives us some good opportunities for OEMs and suppliers to be here in Northwest Florida. We already have an existing and diverse industry of 2,000 manufacturers. We make everything from chemical to wood products and food to wind turbines. Manufacturers can get their products in and out quickly with access to three ports, three commercial airports, major railways, and I-10 that connect us to 75 and 95. We don't have any sales tax on manufacturing machinery and equipment, and we've got industry-driven councils that promote economic growth in manufacturing, such as the Northwest Florida Manufacturers Council and the Technology Coast Manufacturing and Engineering Network, TECMAN, which is here in Okaloosa County. The aerospace and defense industry, some trends in that industry is that there are a record-breaking backlog of aircraft orders for manufacturers. So there's the need for renovations and even the replacement of aging fleet of planes. DOD priorities talk about robotics and autonomous systems, miniaturization, which is making components of weapon systems even smaller, big data, so it's the processing of intelligence data, and then advanced manufacturing such as 3D printing. And, of course, the aging workforce. We've got to increase that pipeline of all levels of aerospace-related training, STEM, mechanics, assemblers, and even worker readiness skills. So here, thanks to Zach and the UWS Haas Center, we've got this great chart. The orange bars represent our location quotient over the past 10 years. And a location quotient indicates how concentrated a particular industry is in a region. It really essentially shows what we have here that's unique. So when a location quotient is greater than one, that means that we have more than our fair share of that industry. So as you can see over time, we've had significantly higher than the national average. Even when our location quotient declines, it's still much higher than what most people, most regions have. Now, what's the reason for you'll see that decline there in our location quotient? It's due to federal spending. So DOD spending in Northwest Florida, when it drops, the industry drops. And so this is just a whole nother reason why we need to help stabilize the aerospace and defense industry here. We've got the expertise, but we need to ensure that we diversify the economy so that we don't depend so much on government contracts. We've got to help our local aerospace and defense companies find more commercial and private sector work. And this is why announcements such as GKN in Panama City and why VTMAE in Pensacola was so important. We want to keep that industry here growing. So how is the aerospace and defense industry competitive here in Northwest Florida? Again, a lot of our manufacturing advantages translate here. So we're close to those six major aerospace OEMs. We've got 500 aerospace and defense companies already here. We've got six major military installations, with the majority of them being aviation-related missions. We've got a labor force of 60,000 in aerospace and defense, and including 6,000 active-duty military that's separating each year. We've got a number of R&D innovation and testing facilities like the Air Force Research Lab and the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition and the Naval Surface Warfare Center. We've got a regional network of support services such as certified aerospace machine shops and engineering firms. We have a number of existing aerospace-related educational and training programs. And we're part of a four-state partnership with Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, to the Aerospace Alliance, to help recruit aerospace companies here in the Southeast. One of the third industry that we focus on is cybersecurity and information technology. Some of the major industry trends here is that there is exponential growth in internet-connected devices. There's increased deployment of web and cloud-based business applications. There's a continued rise of cybercrime, such as the recent hack of Equifax. There's a lot of privacy regulations and the need to share and protect personal data, such as the healthcare industry. And there's a shortage of IT workers and skills in the cybersecurity industry. So here again, thanks to Zach and UWF, we've got this data, this map from CyberSeek. The purple and the pink area is the higher concentration of cybersecurity jobs. Most of them are in larger MSAs, which is another reason which is why our location quotient is even more interesting. There are 3,300 employed here in Northwest Florida in cybersecurity, which is 1,200 more than is expected for a region of our size. So given this unique population and distance from large MSAs, which is likely due to the federal investment in military and homeland security and how it can help support a cybersecurity workforce. So additionally, our advantages here in Northwest Florida, so we've got the Center for Information Warfare Training, which is headquartered at NAS Pensacola Corry Station. They deliver information warfare professionals to the Navy and the Joint Services. Again, we've got our science and technology assets at IHMC and AFRL. We have a concentration of industries and firms with high demand for cybersecurity products and services, such as defense contractors, aerospace manufacturers, and financial service firms. We have access to military personnel and retirees, those with active security clearances. We have a high concentration of cybersecurity occupations, which we saw in the previous slide. UWF is designated as a national security agency and Department of Homeland Security as a national center for academic excellence in cyber defense education. We've got a lot of cybersecurity-related academies offered by local schools and the colleges. Our next industry is financial services. Industry trends that are happening there is continued decentralization of operations, and they're relocating away from traditional financial centers. There's a growing number of financial technology firms called FinTech, which are online lending and retail payment services, investing and advising. We have financial firms that are expecting to pursue digital strategies due to the rise of fintech and digital payment options. There's a strong demand for cloud-based platforms, robotic process automation, and cognitive technologies. So there's a need to replace an aging core of IT, aging core systems, so there's going to be a lot of IT investments. Visits with many site location consultants at Florida's Great Northwest has done has shown that they're saying there's a lot of project activity with e-commerce projects, so that's a lot more financial and data services that'll be needed. So our strengths in this area, you know, again, Navy Federal, they're going to employ up to 10,000 employees soon. We have an average, above average concentration of cybersecurity-related occupations. We've got a multilingual population to serve our diverse customer base, and our region offers quick access to direct flights to major financial markets. And our last industry is water transportation, which includes companies involved in shipbuilding and repair and specialized services for those vessels and transportation-related activities. So we've got DOD priorities in robotics and autonomous systems, including underwater vehicles, shipbuilding that requires specialized occupations, including engineering and skilled trades, both of which are in short supply nationally. We have demand for cybersecurity workers among ports and shipping operators due to the increasing concerns about the security of the nation's trade-related infrastructure. We've got growing trade with Latin America and the Caribbean, and ports are competing to accommodate the growing scale of container ships. So again, another great map from the Haas Center. We have more than 2,500 jobs in the region, which is 2,000 more than expected for a region of our size. Bay County has one of the highest concentrations in the county. So remember when I said that the LQ is greater than one, in the case we have more than our fair share, well, Bay County has 16. So their location quotient is significantly high. And this doesn't even include the effects of the recent Coast Guard contract that they got. The technology of these vessels will require higher skilled workers in the region. So shipbuilding has all the marks of advanced manufacturing that is unlikely to be outsourced or automated and should have the corresponding spillover effects in the region. So how are we competitive? Again, Eastern Shipbuilding, they employ 1,500 here in Northwest Florida. We've got a strong concentration of machine shops and supportive industries, three seaports, two of which are designated foreign trade zones. We've got multiple U.S. Navy installations here, including scientific and technical expertise at the Naval Surface Warfare Center in Panama City. And we have workforce training that begins at the high schools through post-secondary. So we've got to continue to also focus on R&D and innovation to maintain our competitiveness. Because we're going to have industries that we have never dreamed of, our current industries are going to disappear, they're going to morph. So we've got to make sure that R&D and innovation is supported to maintain our competitiveness. A good example is the iPhone, you know, and in all its software applications 10 years ago didn't exist, and look how dependent we are on it today. So we need to support those companies and organizations involved in R&D and innovation, and particularly those that support our targeted industries and encourage their growth in Northwest Florida. So another reassurance that our targeted industries are the best to go after is that they're aligned with what the Brookings Institution says are the main sources of the productivity growth and productivity driving innovations and business models that support higher wages and rising living standards for the average worker in the U.S. All of our targeted industries include the advanced industries, which are heavy in R&D and STEM workers. Workers in the advanced industries represent only 9% of the workers, but they are the bulk of the engineers and the researchers in the U.S., and they primarily encompass manufacturing, engineering, and high-tech services. So our goal is to hope is that we want to help ensure and recruit and help those existing in the industry, companies that are in these five targeted industries, so that they can bring new wealth into the region. So now I want to shift over to our strategic focus areas that are listed within the strategic plan. And we know that in order for our existing businesses to thrive and to attract additional investment from those companies, our community has to be competitive and we have to have a healthy economy. And we know that in order for us to have a healthy economy, we've got to work together across the region in these five key areas in order to build a strong economy. So talent, business vitality, infrastructure, entrepreneurship and innovation, and quality of place. So as I mentioned, we established a council for each of the five areas to review the strategic plan, begin prioritizing initiatives, identify key players, find champions from across the region, and start implementing the plan. So as they've been digesting the strategy and working together, we've made some revisions to the list of this initiatives, and my presentation reflects that. So we'll be sure to get you an updated overview sheet of what those initiatives are in the key strategic areas. So let me talk through each of the councils and give you an overview of those strategies. So the first council is on talent, and the strategic initiatives here help us connect our talent assets to key industry clusters to ensure we have a dynamic and diverse workforce. So the talent initiatives that will significantly impact the region include workforce training for companies in targeted industries that are relocating or expanding in the area, integrating veterans into the workforce, upskill training for underemployed and unemployed, talent recruitment efforts, work-based training for students, the extension of manufacturing academies, and improving employability skills such as soft skills and leadership skills. Our second council is in business vitality, which focuses on recruiting new businesses and supporting existing business expansions. So under this umbrella is we want to ensure that we continue to grow key industry clusters. We want to retain existing businesses and support their expansion efforts. We're going to market and promote Northwest Florida to business prospects and site location consultants. We're going to create and support targeted industry councils. We're going to leverage tourism for business attraction, support our small businesses, and better streamline government processes such as permitting. Our third council is the Infrastructure Council, which works to ensure that the region's economic infrastructure is state-of-the-art and connects communities in every part of the region. Priorities there include having an inventory of ready and available buildings and sites, improving ports and airport, rail and roads for business use, improving our rural infrastructure, improving internet access, and partnering with the regional planning councils. The fourth council is Entrepreneurship and Innovation, which focuses on fostering robust entrepreneurship and innovation ecosystems to drive economic growth. And within there, we want to develop entrepreneurial hubs, increase commercialization tools and programs, increase access to capital, market our entrepreneurial success, support K-20 entrepreneurial programs and curriculum, and promote rural entrepreneurship. And finally, our last is Quality of Place Council. Their goal is to make Northwest Florida a place appealing to existing residents and visitors, as well as to a new generation of talented and creative individuals and companies. Initiatives included within there are developing vibrant downtowns and town centers, identifying fulfilling resident needs, improving amenities in underserved communities, incorporating the needs of targeted industries, and developing win-win environmental and business infrastructure such as stormwater retention, recreation areas. So in order for us to have a sustainable and diversified economy, we must be firing on all cylinders in each of these five areas, and particularly so since they are all interrelated. Our forward councils will continue to drive the implementation of the plan by pulling people together to collaborate across the region and make an impact. And I understand not all initiatives included in this regional strategy are eligible for Triumph dollars, but those that do qualify, I hope that you will seriously consider them. So for more information, you can visit our website at northwestfloridaforward.com or you can contact me. And so I want to close with these final thoughts. And this was a similar slide that was used when we presented to you 2 years ago. and we're still advocating for the same things. We need your help to be successful in transforming our economy. We need your visionary leadership and strength to follow through and make the hard decisions now for the future growth of our region. We want you to know about our regional assets, our unique features and connective tissue on which to build a regional economy. We hope that you will support this regional plan, which provides a common vision and a set of priorities. And we ask that you encourage partnerships between the public and private sector. We want your support to develop product which we can sell. So in other words, project ready, building sites and infrastructure and a highly trained workforce. We'd like your help to build capacity in order to drive and sustain regional economic growth. So if we want employers that we have here now to continue to grow and to attract the large employers of tomorrow, we need to lay the groundwork and begin preparing now. And we need you to be strategic, patient, and confident in your decisions and know that it takes time to see transformational change. So hope this regional strategy is a useful resource for you and provides a framework for the types of initiatives that could help transform Northwest Florida. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Any questions? Members, any questions? Fire away.
Thank you, Chairman. I just want to make a comment. That was a very good presentation, and I know you worked very hard along with leaders throughout this region to put together a thoughtful strategic plan, so thank you.
Thank you.
Stan?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's well said, Dr. Dana, and I almost just second that, but maybe just to expand a bit, thank you, number one, for doing this. And
thank you.
Members, thank you for listening to Kim and seeing this through. You said it, over 800 people, is my understanding, participated
yes, sir,
in the development of this strategy from all of these communities. And it's the first time, at least in recent memory, I think we've been able to garner that many people to participate in a regional conversation.
Right.
And so I think this is really important for the region. And I think it's great input for us. Certainly it's not an absolute set of white lines, if you will, that we need to think about triumph dollars, but it's a pretty good template for us to think about how do we think regionally and to diversify the economy. So I think later we're going to talk through these applications, the documents that have been prepared, and it makes reference to alignment with the regional strategy and the targeted sectors. So I think this was a good primer, if nothing else, for all of us to get ready for that conversation. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Great job, Kim. Very, very good job. Any more comments? Okay, before we move on, let the records reflect that Bob Benezzi is here. Welcome. Glad to have you here. You were late just a few minutes. And also, I did recognize our the other CPA firm, David Tipton, Tipton Marler & Associates, and Jennifer Davidson. They're tag-teaming us, and they'll have a – I think you're going to speak a little bit later on in the program. On financial, okay, Steve's going to do it. Gotcha. Okay. Let's move on now to Dr. Pam Dana and a report from the application committee. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Can everyone hear me back there? Up here. Okay. Good. Well, at our last full board meeting, Chairman, you tasked the applications committee with bringing back a next to final draft within 2 months, and with 1 week to spare, we have a working or next to full, a final draft for you, for the board. And before going into that, though, I'd just like to give you a little bit of briefing on what our committee has been up to in the last 2 months or month and a half. So the applications committee is comprised of Bob Benezzi, Stan Connolly, Jason Schoaf, and myself serving as chair. We held 2 meetings since our last board meeting, the most recent of which was in October, last week, October the 4th. And both meetings were held at the Destin City Annex, and we had very good public participation and attendance, and I'd like to thank the City of Destin for hosting us on both occasions. At each meeting, we spent considerable time as a committee going over or paring down what we consider priorities for the application to capture in terms of the proposals that are submitted. And during our last meeting, or first meeting, excuse me, we heard from representatives of the Governor's Office or Department of Economic Opportunity, which is the state's lead agency for economic development. who were invited to discuss relevant grant programs and economic development efforts they are engaged in that might provide prove helpful to our committee as we design an application and corresponding compliance and reporting processes. They also discussed the various elements involved in their grants oversight and the staff, generally the staff workload that it takes to oversee these applications from proposal all the way through to completion. Now, during these presentations and our committee meetings, it was highlighted that Enterprise Florida currently is administrating a new statewide grant program, the Florida Job Growth Grant Fund, that is very similar to the Triumph funding program in that their program is largely meant to fund public infrastructure projects and workforce training leading to economic development statewide. Per their legislation surrounding this this funding, Enterprise Florida is prohibited to use its appropriated funds for business incentives as in the past have been used. So we thought it relevant to take a closer look at that application as well as the stated priorities of this board and the committee when putting together an application. Now, I took the time to go onto that Florida Job Growth Grant Funding Program and look at the kind of applications that they're receiving, the proposals that they're receiving, and they're pretty diverse. And so I would encourage anyone, if they would like to see kind of how that program's panning out, to go to the Enterprise Florida website and see that. We also have Corey Henderson here from Enterprise Florida that if anyone had additional questions, he agreed to field those. So using the Florida Job Growth Grant Fund application as a relevant foundation, our legal team took the input from our public workshop as well as input from other stakeholders and as well as the priorities expressed by the board and committee members, and they drafted an application for our review today and eventual approval. So with that in mind, I'm going to hand this over to Scott Remington and Elizabeth Billheimer to go over the application in detail to talk about the next steps for grant application, evaluation, and overall administration, and then we'll go from there.
Mr. Chair, before you turn it over, what's being passed out in the audience is also available online at the website. In case you did not get a copy, you can get it electronically at the website.
Okay. Liz, are you up?
I am.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So the application, we actually, at the committee meeting last week, we had started with a draft application. And this draft actually takes into consideration the discussions that were had last week. And so just to go over, I'd like to walk through just the sections of it and how it's laid out and what's contained in each one of the sections. The application includes at the beginning the types of awards that that Triumph is permitted under the statute to make, and they're detailed out so the applicants can understand the terms of the statute. It also lists out the priority considerations that are detailed in the statute itself. The next provision on page 2 are the discretionary priority considerations, and these were created from discussions, I think, at the last board meeting, and then the committee put together a list of priority considerations. And then at the end, there's a general statement that scoring of the actual application, something we'll talk a little bit more about, will actually be done in terms of the application's compliance with the statutory requirements. The next section is the applicant information. That's on page 4. And that includes the identity of the applying either individual, entity, or organization, some background on that individual, entity, or organization, their relevant contact information, and who the primary point of contact will be for the applicant. In addition, it's some information on their website, if there is one. So the board has access to information on the applicant themselves. In addition, the applicant the application asks for additional information on any co-applicants or partners or other entities that will have a role in the project or program that's being proposed. It also asks for the amount of funding that the applicant is seeking. It asks for information concerning whether or not this proposed project or program has applied for funds in the past. And if so, it asks detailed questions about where they applied and the status of those funding requests. And if the program was funded in part, what the status of the program is. There are some information requested on the financial status of the applicant and the co-partners. That would include describing the financial status, and then in separate attachments to the proposal, providing financial statements or other financial information that supports the status of the applicant and co-applicants. The next section relates to the eligibility of the applicants and the proposed project or program. These actually, we have made check boxes, and it will let the applicants themselves check all of the types of program, which category it falls into. And it lets the applicant themselves actually tell the board where they fall. These are taken directly from the statute themselves. Page 7 is a section that will allow the applicant to describe to the board the nature of the proposed project or program. In all of these sections where we ask for a narrative or the application is asking for a narrative, we are permitting we've structured it so the applicant can attach additional sheets if it's necessary, if there's not enough room in the application itself. There is a section for the applicant to describe to the board how the proposed project or program is transformational and how it will affect the disproportionately affected counties over the next 10 years or so. There's a section, a question on data that's available to demonstrate the viability of the proposed project or program, question on how the program will impact the disproportionately affected counties, how that will be measured in the long term. And there is a question about whether the project or program is sustainable and how it's sustainable. They're asked to describe that. And then they're asked to describe the deliverables for the project or program and how those will be measured. The next section are the priorities. And we've listed out a checkbox again for the applicant to tell the board which priorities they believe their project or program meets. The checkboxes are the priorities that are listed in the Triumph statute. There is a section for the applicant to describe how the project or program meets the discretionary priorities, which are listed on page 1 and 2 of the application. There are questions here for the applicant to tell Triumph which of the effective counties will be impacted by the proposed project or program. So if it covers multiple counties, the applicant can circle all that apply if it's going to cover more than one. And there's also a question that details out whether or not the proposed project or program is approved by the Board of County Commissioners for the county or counties that are affected by the program. And we do ask, there's a section in here for applicants to provide evidence that the Board of County Commissioners has approved the project or program. The next section is the approvals and authorities. It's if it's a governmental entity, the relevant approvals that have been obtained. And if they haven't been obtained in advance, the timeline for obtaining those and the process for obtaining those. We also have put a section in here for the applicant to provide evidence to show that they have approval to make the application on behalf of the organization or entity. There's a section on funding and budget for the applicant to describe how much money they are requesting from Triumph. The percentage of total program or project costs that the funding represents. And there is a note that Triumph will be awarding just a set monetary amount and not a percentage of projected costs. But the application also asks questions concerning the number of jobs that will be created from the proposed project or program. And then there are questions concerning the whether or not these requested funds are supplemental to some other source of funding. And if so, it asks to describe that. And then there's a section for the actual budget itself, costs, and the sources of other funding, and then a area for the applicant to describe a detailed budget narrative. We've at the end of the section, we've included a few questions that concern the clawback requirements of the statute and the applicant checking that they understand that the contract portion would include such terms as detailed out in the statute. And then also the requirement that the potential awardees will have to provide reports to Triumph on the status of the award. And then also a question or an acknowledgement by the applicant that the board may request additional information from the applicants. And then finally, pages 14 through the end are addendums that we've created for each of the types of awards that may be made under this. So there's an infrastructure addenda, a workforce training proposals addendum. There's a ad valorem tax rate reduction addendum, a local match requirements addendum, local action plans, an advertising and promotion addendum, and at the end, there's a certification for the applicant or the authorized agent for the applicant to sign the application.
I had a quick question. I saw where we had in there, has this project been approved by the county? Is there anywhere in there or maybe a way to for a county or a city or some other entity to prioritize their projects? For example, I expect we'll get, let's just say, 10 applications for Okaloosa County. I would give more weight towards their number one ask versus their number 10 ask.
There's no provision in the statute for the county commissions to prioritize projects. They're just asked to give you a list. Whether they give you projects in a priority is sort of up to the county's discretion. You could ask them that, but there's no requirement under the statute that the counties prioritize the projects that they give to you for consideration.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. While the statute doesn't require it, nor does the statute prohibit us from doing, as Mr. Riggs says, and that is to ask a proposing entity or an entity that's approving a lot of projects in its name to tell us which ones they view as the most important for their community, right?
That is correct.
Thank
you. Yes, sir.
Any more questions on the process? Pam, we'll turn it back over to you, Dr. Dana.
Thank you, Chairman. I just want to point out for the board, probably the most important, well, let me backtrack. The application itself is very similar to what I described earlier, the Florida Job Growth Grant Program. And we structured the foundation of our application near to that program or that application from Enterprise Florida, because for them it's structured sufficiently broad to allow for ample flexibility, and that's important for us, and it's important for the communities in their proposal stages. So what's most important, I would think, for the board to concentrate on is on page 2 and 3, where we tried to capture the discretionary priorities that the board and the committee and the stakeholders and individuals at the workshop, public workshop we held, voiced. So we've tried to capture those. And obviously, the first section of bullets on page 2, those are in law. The second set of bullets on 2 and 3, those come from this board, the committee, and the public. So I hope that we've captured your expressed sentiments. And if not, then please make note of it so that we can try to capture them.
Any more questions?
I don't want to jump the gun. Are we going to talk about the pre-screening process? Or
what I thought we'd do is before all of these issues we're getting ready to go over, as you can see on this clip, folks, I think we might want to talk about each one. And then once everyone feels comfortable with, you know, the process, the economic advisor and things like that, then we begin taking these up as action items, unless there's an objection to that. Okay. So how about let's talk about the pre-screen. Liz?
So in addition to the draft application, we have also put together, and this was discussed at the committee meeting, we put together a one-page pre-screening form. And this, we have created this as an optional pre-screening process, and it would provide initial consideration of potential ideas for proposed projects or programs. Applicants aren't required to participate in this pre-screening process. They can jump straight to the full application, the way we have it structured in this particular handout. And even if the Triumph were to decide that the pre-screening doesn't necessarily meet their priorities, and they provide that information back to the applicant, the applicant could still nonetheless fill out the full application. There's nothing stopping an applicant from completing one. The form is very simple. We've limited the response to 3 pages. It provides just basic information about who's applying, the background of that entity, individual, organization, contact information, co-applicants, and then a summary description, 3 pages in length, that describes the program and how much money they're requesting from Triumph. And at the end of it, there's an important note that this pre-screening, any results from the pre-screening, does not mean that the applicant will be awarded funds. This is just an initial read on ideas for potential projects and programs. And then the last part of it is all applicants, even if they go through the pre-screening, will still be required to fill out the full application for the board.
And members, my first look at the application was, wow, this is long. It is very long. But, you know, all you have to do is pick up the newspaper, or we can read our emails, and you know, I've seen applications for projects up to $100 million in size. I don't think you can frame an application for a $500,000 application any different than $100 million, maybe, possibly. But if we're going to be approving $300 million worth of money, dollars to be spent, I think we should know a lot. We should be we need to be prudent and smart and do our due diligence. And so is it a long, lengthy application? You bet. Could we streamline it? Maybe. But and feel free at this meeting to, you know, if you want to change it, feel free. But it's pretty dadgum thorough, as far as I can tell. So having said that, members, do you have any questions of Dr. Dana on this part of it? Stan?
Maybe I'm asking the team that wrote the pre-screening a question. When we left our last meeting, I did not leave with the understanding that the pre-screening was going to be optional. And so maybe I'm just seeking to understand that point. I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of somebody that intends to apply if it's optional, why would they fill out the pre-screen? And one of the benefits, I think, we talked about of the pre-screening process is just to help the applicant think through all the issues and get some initial feedback on that. And as well, and I'm not sure we did talk about this, but I'd like to at least point it out, that I think in time we, or whoever the screening team is, could almost play matchmaker. And forgive the analogy, but it's an opportunity for applicants that might not be as strong to partner up with somebody that might not be as strong, and collectively they created a better application. And so my primary question is, why optional with those ends in mind?
Yeah, before Scott and team follows up on that, Stan is correct. We, as a committee, voted to recommend to the board that we do have a pre-application, and we voted to recommend to the board that we consider a rolling application process. We voted to recommend that the board consider securing a high-level economic advisor who can assist us verify ROI and economic impacts into the future. And we voted to recommend to the board that the board consider securing a grants administration team of sorts that would assist in screening or pre-screening, receiving and reviewing applications, coordinate with legal team to ensure reporting and compliance, et cetera. I was going to let Scott, though, go through all of this first and his presentation first, but that's important that we did vote as a committee on these items, but perhaps our legal counsel has perspectives that may want us to rethink as a full board whether we do that or not. So they accommodating our committee vote, put together that pre-application.
And Mr. Connolly, I can tell you there's nothing that in this form that would, you know, can easily be made mandatory. I think one of the charges that we were given early on, and this is our first full board meeting, was how fast can we deploy this money? And is there a way to have some of this money deployed by the end of the year? So working backwards from that goal, we tried to come up with a calendar. If there are projects that we hear are out there and ready to apply that believe they are highly qualified, if we were going to have any chance at deploying one by the end of the year, then the application process would have to essentially start today. And if we are going to require pre-screening, then we're going to have to find somebody who's going to perform the pre-screening. And most likely the soonest we could appoint a committee to do that today, and perhaps that's what the board will do, is appoint a committee to select a pre-screener, administrator, or someone else. But that will necessarily delay the time in which they will have to review applications, depending on how quickly we can get them in, or even review pre-applications. So it's certainly, our recommendation would be you make it optional. However, if the board, its desire to make it mandatory, it's easily done.
Members?
Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I've never filled out an optional form in my life. I try hard not to fill out required forms. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Dana, and I often am. I took the pre-screening process or pre-screening form also to be a way where interested, well-intentioned individuals or groups who have really good ideas but don't fit at all within Triumph Gulf Coast would be able to be very respectfully informed that your idea is a great one, but you may want to go see the Boy Scouts about that project. Or that may be the kind of thing that, you know, ought to go to the legislature for a local bill or something like that. It may not fit, as opposed to putting somebody who's well-intentioned, who has a good idea, but it just doesn't fit, even within Triumph Gulf Coast, through the drill of putting together a long application. So I took all of the objectives that have been laid out here as being proper objectives of pre-screening, but also an opportunity for people to select themselves out once they understand, you know, kind of what the criteria are, or to be gently told, you're welcome to make an application, but this is probably the subject of, you know, some other application to some other entity for some other purpose. So unless the pre-screening is going to result in either what Mr. Connolly says, and that is some applicants being encouraged to go together on a project, or unless it is used for the purpose of indicating to people that they have a major hole that they need to go back and think through, or unless it's for the purpose of telling folks that this probably doesn't fit, I think it's extra time. But if it's any or all of those things, it would seem to me that Mr. Connolly's right, that this ought to be a not an extra step, but a way to actually save time, and ought to therefore be mandatory.
Okay. Dr. Dana?
Thank you, Chairman. And our committee agrees with what you just said. Our committee voted in accordance with that, or agreed with it. But, again, the legal counsel had another perspective based on timing and several other factors, and they're trying to help us move forward. And if an applicant, if a pre-applicant didn't fall under the criteria and we proposed to them to apply with the Boy Scouts, they can still submit a full application. Yep. So they just wanted to make that clear. But accommodating us, I don't think they have a – they don't care either way. They're just trying to help us.
We don't have a dog in the front in the hunt as to whether it's mandatory or
so
permissive.
Let's move it forward. Is there anyone that objects to having it mandatory? Okay. It's mandatory. Keep going. I'll move this meeting along.
I know you are. I know how you work. I'll make this one quick. National average versus regional average on wages. Is the standard for national averages, and I can't believe I'm going to say it quite this way, higher than we want it to be? I don't know what the regional average and national averages are.
That's a good point.
And are we setting the bar in an inappropriate level?
That's a good point. That's a good point.
And I'm sorry. I should have been more clear, Dr. Dana. Page 2 of the application, within the discretionary priorities, that got past me from our last meeting. I think Bob may have mentioned it. It didn't register with me. Bob, you saw that last time. I think we missed this. Maybe we just, unless the statute requires it, we just say promote net new jobs in the private sector with an income above the regional average.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's mentioned in the statute. I'll defer to the legal team, but I believe it's in the statute.
There you go.
That language comes directly from the statute.
Okay.
Chairman?
Good point.
Chairman?
Dr. Dana?
However, it is discretionary priority. That means that even though it's in the statute, that second bunch of bullets are what's coming from the board as what we would look at also.
So what you're saying is even if that is – if that's the case, there are other bullets out there, other parts of the application that can offset that.
I would just ask the group, let's just verify what the statute says and the intent. And if we can place emphasis on things above our regional average, I think we should do so. Keep it that simple.
Mr. Connolly, I have the statute in front of me.
Okay.
It says, the specific language says, quote, increase household income in the disproportionately affected counties above national average household income.
And I'm differentiating between household income and jobs. So is there another discretionary way to measure that I think gives us a little latitude?
Under your set of discretionary priorities, you could certainly list that as an additional metric that you would like measured.
Absolutely. I might have to find a way to do that if we could, Mr. Chairman.
I agree. It will probably keep us from approving the application today, but unless we want to have a conference call after it gets cleaned up a little bit with Stan's language in there, I totally agree. Or perhaps we pass, if we do approve the application today, the pre-app and the app, per-
perhaps it's subject to being modified, as Stan talked about.
I like
about.
That.
Okay, all right. More questions? Take your time. I'm not trying to move you along. I'm just, this is a long, very thoughtful, well-developed application process. So,
Mr. Speaker?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, I yield. No, go ahead. Mr. Riggs. I yield.
I just want to make sure I got the process down correctly. So there's a pre-application process. And at some point, we will respond to every pre-applicant that submits that to us. Is that correct?
If we went with a pre-application, which we just voted to do so, then we would have essentially the first phase would be an intent to apply.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be those who review those brief intent to applies and say, yes, you meet the minimum criteria, or no, you don't.
Okay.
So, yes.
So are we going to set up a committee in order to handle the pre-application process, or are we going to take that on as a board?
I think this is part of the presentation that Scott had prepared, and I don't know how, if we want to, well, Scott, you go ahead.
The answer to that is, it's up to you. This is brand new territory we're in. You can form a committee to do it. You can do it as an entire board, or you can hire staff to do it and designate the staff perform the pre-application process, which is what we've recommended, because your staff wouldn't be constrained with the scheduling difficulties and the sunshine law restrictions that you all have to comply with. So they could meet and on a rolling basis consider pre-applications as they come in and issue some guidance to the applicants.
Good.
I like that. Mr. President.
Thank you, Speaker. Dr. Dana, going to page 8 of the application, and by the way, I agree with Speaker Benz. I looked at it and I thought, boy, this is long, but then when I heard the explanation of it, this makes sense, and a lot of the length is the appendices in the back, which don't pertain to, you know, probably anybody very much. On number 6, describe how the proposed project or program is sustainable. There was recently good presentation in Pensacola. Quint Studer arranged for it, had somebody come in from who has national reputation and talked about how a lot of great projects get funded without a lot of thought to how they're sustained in the out years. So you wind up dumping something on local government or dumping something on a university or an institute or private sector, and 3 or 4 years out, they're sucking air because, you know, they don't have the money. So I'm wondering, Dr. Dana, if there might be just, and again, we don't have to, this can be subject to just editorial changes by you. I'm happy to vote for that. But could we add some kind of sentence or explanation of what we mean by sustainability, so that there's an obligation on the applicant's part to tell us in the out years where the money's going to come from to keep this new building floating, or to keep that
right.
New, you know, bridge up or whatever it is that we're going to build?
I personally, and I, yes, I think that we can absolutely strengthen that, put in there a sentence that strengthens that language. Also in the discretionary priorities on page 3, there is a second bullet that says demonstrate long-term financial sustainability following Triumph Gulf Coast funding. But, yes, we can strengthen that, and I agree.
Yeah, I'm just looking there for be more specific. Tell us how. You know, when do the lines cross and you have to actually keep this balloon afloat yourself, and how are you going to do it?
Scott, if you could take care of that language that we just discussed, then that also should be part of the ultimate motion to add to it. Any more questions? Jason?
Mr. Speaker, I have something I mentioned in an earlier meeting and since have received feedback from some of the smaller counties. And I don't know what the rest of the board's feeling is on this. Their concern was they don't have staff that can prepare, for example, on page 11, where it lists out costs for construction, reconstruction, land acquisition improvement. They don't have the staff together to do this. They would have to go out, spend money, have an engineering firm or a third party help them put together these figures to be accurate enough to put into this application. What is your thought on perhaps on the pre-screening form for them to have an amount they're requesting that can come out of, if approved, would come out of their amount for the project? And again, I know it's a there's a lot to that, but some of the larger counties may have staff that can easily put together this, whereas some of the smaller counties cannot unless they receive some money to help pay for this.
I would open up to the full board about your thinking on that.
Members, what are your thoughts?
Mr. Speaker, since Pete Antonacci is here, I wonder if we could put him on the spot. Pete, with Speaker's permission, wanted to ask you this question. You will have and do have entities come before you with valid and useful ideas, but you know they don't have a $60,000 consultant to put everything together. How do you provide either technical assistance, or how do you advise the answer to this kind of a question? Because you're getting it just like we now are getting it.
Right, and we have about 150 proposals, and we have no financial mechanism, Mr. Schoaf, to provide for some kind of underwriting for them, even upon success. We have made technical experts at the Department of Economic Opportunity available to those communities, but I can tell you that the communities that are motivated and some of the smallest counties in Florida have made application to our fund, and they are lengthy and perhaps onerous, but if you want to do it, you'll put the time into doing it. At least that's been our view, and we haven't been wanting for applicants.
Mr. Speaker, may I just follow up? Mr. Antonacci, what happens if a apparently qualified applicant were to come to your agency and say, we really need some help in doing some calculations here on return on investment or things that we don't typically do? Do you have technical staff who then assist them? They don't write the application for them, right, but they tell them what you mean and how to do it?
Right. We have DEO staff, economists that are available to answer questions or perhaps even do the rudimentary work, the basis work perhaps. But that's about it.
This is off into the stratosphere, Speaker. So
I know where you're heading. Keep going.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I'm wondering if we might be able to have some kind of an understanding with Mr. Antonacci and his agency. Maybe we have to pay for this, or maybe they do it for the good of the order, but to help out some of these smaller counties or smaller applicants that Jason's talking about here, is there, you know, is that a possibility? And
Pete?
Mr. Chairman, yeah.
We'd free be sounds really good to me.
We'd be happy to do it. That's what we're here for. To the extent that we can help, we will. And we provide the same service to applicants to this process as we do to our own. Our resources are available to you.
Thank you, Mr. Antonacci, very much.
Dr. Dana, stay there, Dr. Pete. Dr. Dana?
Thank you for your kind offer. Also, the representatives from the Governor's Office, Department of Economic Opportunity, they also offered their assistance where needed. So very happy to have partners that are willing to help us. Thank you.
Dr. Dana, the application process has been collaborative. We have really pored over the applications as a team with our DEO counterparts. It's been laborious, but I think we've weeded out the less than worthy, and we've got a good group of worthies that are potentially available to fund.
Jason, does that help you a little bit?
It sure does, and I will recommend to anyone that has that concern to first do their pre-screening application and get a nod on this before they approach the state for their help. Thank you.
Stan?
I might suggest we as a board and our staff go one step further, and that is make available on our website contact information, if it's not there already, Susan, directly to the groups that can provide that, so we're not having to broker that at all times. They've got direct access. We can point them to that.
My only concern would be when anything that I get that's for free, you know, sometimes it's not as good as if you pay for it. I'm not implying that if we did not pay you for your services that you would not do as good a job. But if we pay you, then there are certain expectations I think that we could have. But, you know, I'm trying to save money too, but we might want to consider, you know, how we reimburse DEO for the time they spend on projects like that. Pete?
I don't have any thoughts about that. I really think we have the capacity to help. Plainly, we can't sprinkle pixie dust on everything and make it good, but we can help the applicants as we've done so far.
Good.
So I don't think compensation is necessary.
Okay. But if we're ready.
We've spent so much time already on this process. We might as well leverage that experience and lend it to you.
I'm kind of thinking, too, that $335,000 wire we sent you for interest yesterday for the last month might help a little bit. No.
Well, I wasn't aware of that. Nobody told me. But actually, I was afraid to say no because Mr. Conley and I work together.
I'm playing. I'm just playing. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Everyone? Yes, sir, Scott.
Just briefly, I mean, this may help allay some of your concerns. You'll note that one of the specific award categories that the legislature has identified is under award sub B, local match requirements of section 288.0655 for projects in the disproportionately affected counties. That statute specifically references the Rural Infrastructure Fund, and there are funds available through the Department of Economic Opportunity for, I believe, four of our eight disproportionately affected counties, where they can apply for grants for planning, infrastructure, engineering, that sort of thing. We, when this issue had come up in the past, we've reached out to all the county attorneys in each of those counties to inquire whether they have utilized that resource in the past and just make sure that they were aware of it and that as matching funds, Triumph could be an eligible source for that need.
Okay, keep going. These are good observations. I don't think it takes a modification of our motion at all. I think we just have that understanding. Anyone else have any questions or thoughts on the process itself, the pre-app and the app?
Just one more, Mr. Speaker.
Sure.
And that is, if you go to the end, which I guess is on page 13, and I wanted to ask Dr. Dana if the committee had any conversation about this. If the first stage of our work is pre-screening and the second stage is validation and the third stage is a board selection, as I read this, the fourth stage that you've implied and expressed is a monitoring and a reporting on performance. And what I'm wondering is, do we also need to ask the applicant to confirm that the applicant will make available to this board such financial statements and records that are necessary for us to know how metrics are being followed and how milestones are being met. There could be a circumstance in which an award is made and there's some sort of public-private partnership or something and somebody says, well, or a private foundation or a public foundation, and somebody says, well, those are our books. You know, you gave us the money and take our word for it. I don't know that that would happen, but I know it has happened. And I know that being sensitive to the concerns of the legislature, when the legislature hears words like that, that we can't know what's going on when we give you money, then that creates a political situation that we don't want to be involved in. So to prevent that, I'm just wondering, would it be a friendly suggestion to ask applicants to provide an assurance up front that they would make available to us necessary records and books to validate the claims that milestones are being met and metrics are being followed.
And that the books and records of any affiliates that might be associated with this in some way or fashion are open for us to inspect.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Dana?
That's a very good suggestion, and I don't see why we cannot have a question in there and a box to check, yes or no.
Everyone agree? Okay, and Scott, we now have three proposed sort of changes. If you could begin putting those in writing so that when we ultimately vote on that motion on the application, that it's subject to those these three things that we've asked to have modified so far. Next, any more? Dr. Dana?
So just to clarify Senator Gates, President Gates' comments on the on just to clarify the phases, we would go into the pre-application phase and the review of the, you know, the screening of those. Then it would go into the project application, so phase two of project application. The next phase would obviously be our verification and due diligence, and thereafter we would apply scoring and then decisions on applications, contract negotiations, and then of course the compliance reporting, etc.
Okay, Dr. Dana, do you want to continue on? Shall we give this football off to Scott from here, or do you want to continue?
Scott.
He has a laundry list of issues that deal with this.
Probably Scott should continue, and that will probably spur more questions from the board.
Right. Scott, we have, we've sort of gone through number one. Well, I don't think we've gone through the timeline that closely, have we?
Okay. Pardon me. I think that that's where I'd sort of start in the in the information packet in front of you is tabs A through G. Tab A was a timeline we were asked to put together basically to say how fast could we deploy money under a best-case scenario, and the trigger that we were shooting for was trying to do so before the end of this year. Obviously, we lost some time by not being able to meet due to Irma, but if we were able to shoot the moon and meet all these deadlines, it is theoretically possible that we could deploy funds by the end of the year or be very close to doing so. The chronology starts with today, the board meeting. If the board is able to approve an application and a pre-application process today and form a subcommittee on from the recommendation from the subcommittee on applications, that would need to be done today. We also believe that the board would need to create a subcommittee to select a program administrator and scoring entity, as well as an economic advisor. Those were also recommendations that came out of Dr. Dana's committee. And then the board would probably want to set a deadline for initial project application consideration. Now, we say it's not an application deadline because we're on a rolling basis, but we will set dates where certain times where the board will consider what applications are out there. When we have meetings, you know, in order to get that stuff to you in a timely manner, you know, there will be some deadlines for having applications in if they're going to be considered.
So what you're saying is by 11/15/17, that's a deadline for the initial project application. So if you're thinking about getting money from Triumph, the first deadline is November 15th?
I would suggest to you that that should probably be modified to be the pre-application.
Okay.
Consideration deadline, because remember, you have to have a team in place to review your pre-applications, and this was based on having that team in place to very quickly turn around the applications themselves.
It's pretty aggressive.
Very aggressive.
And Mr. Speaker, just to clarify, Dr. Dana, you're recommending, are you not, a rolling application process? So this is not a race to the courthouse to see who can get there by the middle of November. This is if there are applications that are ready by the middle of November, that we could then consider them in this fashion. But this is, I'm just saying this, I guess, for the audience who's here and anybody who may be listening at home. This is not a suggestion, is it? that that if you miss the bus on the 15th of October, you've missed the bus.
But the bus will be back. It'll be back January 1. I mean, we can set up some kind of a date. We sure don't want folks to try to scurry and do on their pre-app something that is not as accurate as they would like. And maybe we talk about this aggressive timeline. I mean, I think we've talked about trying to get some money up before the end of the year, but I want to make sure that we do it right and we give everyone sufficient time to prepare the application. I'm not ready to say, no, we need to abandon this timeline. I'd like to hear from members. Silence is deafening. We'll stick with it. I didn't hear anyone say any differently, so let's go for it. Dr. Dana?
So to answer Senator Gates's question, the committee, application committee, voted to move forward with a rolling process. And the reason for that is that we did not want to have a deadline for applications, and then all of a sudden the transformational proposal of the world or project of the world came a-knocking, and we, too bad. So that was where our hearts were when we voted. Now, legal counsel has suggested that we do a sort of a rolling, perhaps we do a quarterly, just as you do, you have 11/15 deadline, you have in another quarter or January, you have another deadline. There was a suggestion. Well, Scott, you probably want to bring up the suggestion about.
Sure. And a lot of this is happening very quickly. I think we envision a rolling process, but there being set times where you will consider and vote on proposals. And one of the requirements of the statute is that before you finally approve a proposal, there has to be 14 days notice to the community before the approval. At the same time, to have some order, you can have a rolling process, but if we know when your meetings are going to occur and we know that's likely the date that application, you know, awards will be considered, if you want to be considered by that date, there may be a consideration deadline. Now, what we have proposed as an amendment to your bylaws is a provision where at any time, if the great project were to arise, you could, by a supermajority vote of the board, suspend those rules and take something up on an accelerated timeline or immediately if there's a supermajority vote of the board. But otherwise, we see that in order to be able to process things, get them to you in time to consider, and meet regularly scheduled meeting deadlines, there probably will be some sort of cutoff for applications to be considered at this meeting.
Okay. Everybody okay with that? I remember now, we did talk about the initial project application being the pre-app. And from a pre-app, we moved to the formal application. Are we on the gun on that to get that done, or do we let it, after we've reviewed the pre-app, I'm just trying to think through, and our economic advisor or group says it's a go. Then that entity or community or whatever would, at that point in time, begin filling out the formal application. Any feel, Dr. Dana, how long that process would take once we receive a completed application? Because we're going to get asked this, so you might as well get ready.
We've had that discussion.
Yeah, I think, Speaker Vince, that will depend on the number of applications and the size of your staff, or the size of the body reviewing the applications. The assumption here is that at your November meeting, we're able to put that team, have a selection committee come with a recommendation and put that team in place. And then once that team is in place, applications may begin, you know, as soon as you approve a pre-application process, we can start receiving pre-applications. And as soon as those are reviewed, which would start at the end of presumably the November 8th meeting when that company or individual was identified to do the pre-screening, then as soon as the pre-screenings were returned to the applicant, they would then be eligible to turn in a formal application. And so, you know, you're likely looking at probably not taking up consideration. The earliest you could take up consideration of an award would probably be January or February of 2018.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Speaker, question?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Dana, could you distinguish between a program administrator and an economic advisor?
I can try. An economic advisor, I would envision, would be someone highly credentialed, respected, doesn't have a dog in the hunt. Perhaps it's not even from Northwest Florida. Perhaps it's from Tampa, Tallahassee. And that advisor would do an analysis of the ROI, the economic impact, understanding where our state's going, you know, take into consideration the Northwest Florida strategic plan that we saw earlier, and all of that, and help us understand how this particular proposal ranks compared to another. Obviously, it's going to be the board that takes the priorities and the priority discretionary priorities and other scoring factors, puts them together and makes decisions. So it still rests in our hands. But the economic advisor part is just capturing that economic expertise. Now, for a program administrator, that's more, it can be twofold. The program administrator would work alongside with Susan. It may be a firm, it may be an individual or a team, and they would be the place where the applications come to, the place that, you know, makes ensures that the application is intact and organized proper. They would work with the legal team to make sure everything in there is legal and that it's Scott, you have the
we prepared a sort of a draft request for proposals for both an economist and a program administrator team, and they're at tab C in the materials before you.
So beyond the so once all the applications come in, and then they would coordinate the vetting, the technical vetting of it, due diligence, et cetera.
The administrator and their staff.
Huh?
The administrator and the staff would do all the vetting and whatnot.
Correct. And once we would make the approval, it would be Scott's team that would do the contract negotiations. And then once the contract negotiations come back to the program administration team, then they would follow up on the compliance, the reporting. And there's another element, which would be independent scoring that could, well, Scott, you can.
Your program administrator could be your scoring entity, or that could be divided into two separate categories. In other words, you could score the proposals in-house based on the requirement under the statute that everything be scored. So you have a scoring mechanism. The score doesn't necessarily dictate how the awards are made. They're just one objective metric that you use in evaluating how to make awards.
And that's a very important point. Scoring doesn't drive decisions. It's one element of the overall process.
Correct. So we recommend if you appoint a subcommittee to look into this issue, they would determine whether or not you want one entity who is qualified to act as both the scoring entity and the administrator, or whether or not that needs to be two separate entities. Then your economist, really, I think if I have captured the what I've heard, the sort of will of the board is that you'd like somebody who is almost akin to a staff member who can give you advice on proposals once you have a score in front of you, once you have all the different data points, can kind of guide you through and give you recommendations on what you think will create the most increased economic activity in the disproportionately affected counties. Because ultimately that's your charge, is to increase that economic activity and diversity.
Mr. President, any more?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the explanation raises questions about whether the subcommittee had a preference for, are we going to hire two or three staff people? Are we going to go out and look for people or entities who do this for a living and we have a contract with them? I look at an RFQ, and I look at the timeline that the speaker says we're going to try to meet, and you get into a complicated RFQ process, and I'll see you in April. So I just wondered what your thinking was.
Our thinking was, as a committee, that we would like to handle, if the board wants us to move in that direction, to handle the securing of an economic advisor and a program administrator slash scorer, akin to how you handled bringing on a legal team and akin to how Steve and the committee brought on the CPA team. More of a maybe an invitation to negotiate or, you know.
How do we do it with Scott? How do we do it with you and David? How did we? I think you just negotiated with them.
Well, Speaker, what we did is we sent out an invitation to meet with us to law firms around the area. I think there were about 12 of them or so.
You put them on the clock. You got to respond by a certain time.
Yeah, respond by a certain time. And then those who responded, we met with the ones who were interested. Some weren't. Some declared conflicts or potential conflicts. We wound up meeting with those who were interested, and Bob and I met independently with firms, and then we came back with a recommendation to you.
Same thing with Steve and the CPA firm, correct?
A little less formal, because I'm in this business. Right. I knew who the players were, so I made various phone calls to see who may be interested, and then from there negotiated.
So why don't we do that process for an economic advisor and a program administrator? Worked pretty good the first time around.
Well, I think that's what Scott's recommendation to.
But are you saying RFP, RFQ?
I had a problem with the RFQ title as well.
Whatever we did last time, whatever we call that.
That's just a title to try to describe what we're looking for. It can be as informal as you did it with the last two processes.
So we could theoretically form another subcommittee. The way we formed the subcommittee to find our lawyer and CPA. Same thing with an economic advisor. We form a quick subcommittee, do it today. Same thing with program administrator. We put them to work, and by the November meeting, we figured out who they should be and get with Susan or our lawyer to talk about dollars. At some point, we need to talk about how much to spend, but that's a function of what responsibilities they have and what liabilities they have. But we do have a little bit of time to kind of come up with those subjective issues right now. Well, I don't want to move too quickly. You make a good point. If we go through the RFQ, RFP process, it'll be next summer. It worked last time. We got a good lawyer and a good CPA. Let's stick to that same process unless someone objects. Stan?
Not an objection, maybe just an alternative to us to at least consider. Mr. Antonacci spoke to us a few minutes ago about having advisors on his staff. I wonder if he could at least comment about the qualifications of his folks, if he's still here, to provide this service and us not have to go through an RFQ or whatever the process is we use an existing asset.
Good
There's probably
idea.
Pros and cons to that, but at least explore it.
You're recognized. You didn't realize you had a big job here today, did you?
Oh, I'm glad I'm here.
We are too.
Thank you. So, Mr. Conley, on the Economist, I think we'd have to go shop that ourselves. As far as someone to do the kind of work you need to assemble the documents, make sure that they're vetted properly and subjected to whatever criteria you want to subject them to, we can supply that person without any charge.
Say that differently.
I don't speak any other language.
So,
yeah.
Ahead, let me just suggest that whatever subcommittee you or this board decide to appoint today, that they consider approaching Mr. Antonacci with that option.
Yeah, gotcha. Happy to do that. Obviously, something like that would require some details, okay. But
you probably have some names as well of folks that we can approach.
Yeah, great.
Okay, so with respect to that issue, We're going to utilize the same methodology we used, again, to hire our legal team and CPA. And that group will we need to form two subcommittees. These probably take motions, I would think. So once we get the motions passed, then we'll form the subcommittees to get cranked up. Now, we moved you off your timeline. Continue back with your timeline.
And this is just sort of discretionary to try to give, make sure that everybody knows what the expectations are for everyone in the board. But if
you have to have a map, you don't always follow the map like I don't.
But this is progress, which is what we're trying to do. If we're able to come back on November the 8th and retain an administrator and a scorer and an economist, that'll be a large step forward. That means that shortly after the 8th, we can start accepting pre-applications. We would hope that Dr. Dana's committee, we believe, can come back at that November 8th meeting as well with a recommendation on a scoring system or matrix, how we're actually going to, what rubric to apply to the applications for your consideration and approval on November 8th. If all of those things are in place and the pre-application process begins, it will then be a question, probably I would recommend at the November 8th meeting, we try to map out when we would like to see the first awards deployed, the first funds deployed, and work back from that date as to when sort of that rolling consideration deadline will have to be set. We'll probably have better information from the administrator and better, you know, information from our economist on the time constraints they believe are out there. We may also have a better sense, because we'll have a month of pre-applications
filtering in,
we may have a better idea of what kind of demand to expect as soon as those pre-applications are ruled upon in terms of applications. So I think it may make sense to wait until that November 8th meeting to set the next set of deadlines for funding, with the understanding that if the pre-application, if the bylaws are amended and if we get a pre-app that just blows us away, we can always move to suspend the rules and with a supermajority push somebody to the front of the line if there's an emergency or exigent circumstances, or if we risk losing a project. That would be my recommendation, Mr. Speaker.
Okay. How about if you continue on with your legal report? Or do y'all want to take action on A, B, and C, members? First page. First page. A was the proposed timeline, which I think we basically said, let's just use what we have as a guideline. I'm not prepared to accept a motion for that. But B, presentation of the proposed application. Should we also throw in there and pre-app? We discussed it. Now it's time for action. C, the draft of the RFP economic advisor. Well, we're not going to call it an RFP. We're going to, what are we going to call it?
I think you're just appointing a subcommittee to select
an
economist and a.
But that takes it. That takes a motion. Okay.
Correct.
So we've gotten through that part. Bylaws. Let's get through the tough, the thick weeds to begin with, and don't be afraid to take our time. This is a big thing that we're doing today, y'all. This is really big. I know we've been here for a long time. And we haven't even gotten to public participation yet, so this could be a long meeting, but it is a most important meeting, and I think we've gotten some good input already.
Are you ready for a motion on B, sir?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Speaker, I move that Dr. Dana's report of a proposed application be adopted with Scrivener's changes to conform with the discussion that we've had at this meeting.
And there are basically three major, and we all understand those three, and we all agree upon those, correct? There's a motion. Is there a second? Jason Schoaf seconds. Any questions and discussion? Dr. Dana, you recognize the discussion.
Obviously, I will vote for this. However, do we want to offer up editorial license to the legal counsel if they find grammar issues or things that they need to resolve in the application?
Mr. Speaker, my motion included the flexibility to make Scrivener's changes or to have the legal team make whatever necessary editorial changes are required. So my motion encompasses that, if the seconder will agree to that.
And I would suggest that we have a timeline that you get this back to us with the changes that have just been made. I don't think it needs to be part of the motion, but I'm hoping that within today's Tuesday, by Friday, you can get us back those via email so we can review them. And if anyone has any objections or problems, please let Susan Skelton know or Scott Remington know or Liz know. Does that sound okay? Stan?
Mr. Chairman, so I'm clear, does your motion include the pre-application?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Any more discussion? Motion and second. Is there any objection to the motion and second? Show the motion approved. Okay, why don't you continue, Dr. Dana? Wonderful job so far. Key word so far. We've still got ways
to go. To the committee.
Do you want to continue with the do we want to do the bylaw amendment, or do you want to continue with your presentation?
I'm going to defer to Scott on that since he has more to go over.
I believe maybe the next reasonable action item would be to appoint the subcommittee for the economist and the program administrator.
So let's do we have a motion and a second to appoint a subcommittee to find an economic advisor and a administrator? Is there a motion to form two separate subcommittees?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Speaker, I so move that the chairman appoint those two subcommittees for those purposes.
And are there any volunteers? We'll get to volunteers. Get it passed first. We'll work on volunteers later. Any questions? Stan seconds. Motion second. Sorry about that. Discussion? Go ahead, Pam. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Question for Scott. Do you recommend two different subcommittees, or is it more efficient to have one? Or I'm just asking the question.
It's really six and one half a dozen of the other. Because of, I think the economist is seen as a unique standalone position for the board and wouldn't necessarily be associated with the scoring entity. If there are two, that's fine. If you are working with, you know, Mr. Antonacci or somebody else, and they have dual solutions, it may save time to have one subcommittee, but that's completely up to the pleasure of the board.
What is the pleasure of the board? Two committees or one?
Mr. Chair, as a matter of convenience, all the meetings have to be noticed and located in public, so two committees would be
cumbersome. I know where you are in this issue. How about if we consolidate to one committee? Does anyone have objections to that? Would you modify your motion accordingly?
Yes, sir.
And second, Stan, would you modify your second? Okay. We're still in the discussion. A question, Faith. Good point, too, Dr. Dana. We're still in discussion. Any objections to the motions and second? Without objection, show the motion passes. Now let's skip on to bylaw amendments. Continue.
I'm okay to move on. Thank you.
I'll come back to you. Don't worry. Scott, you're recognized.
Thank you, Speaker, and congratulations. Those are two huge steps for Dr. Dana's committee and a lot of hard work. So kudos for that. In tab D of your binder, this really falls kind of under the category of sort of cleanup work to the bylaws of the corporation. There are specifically nine changes that we are suggesting being made to the bylaws. I've only included in your packet the red line of the changes to the bylaws. They were previously approved by the board, and I'll walk through them. And the first one is simply just stating that these are the amended and restated bylaws of Triumph Gulf Coast, and because of a typographical error, Triumph was misspelled in the last set. On the next page, which shows page 3 of 15. The second change is adding a provision to your bylaws which allows you to have telephone or video conference meetings. It just explicitly states that if you do conduct meetings by electronic means, there'd be public access and the ability for public participation, and mirrors some of the other provisions of Florida statutes in that fashion. On the opposing page, under page 4 of 15, you'll see we've added a provision for a supermajority vote that states that except as otherwise required by law or by the Articles of Incorporation, any act or action of the board which requires a supermajority vote will be deemed to require the affirmative vote of at least 66% of the total number of all board of directors at a meeting at which a quorum is present. What that means is if we had a quorum of 5 people, it would require 4 votes for a supermajority. 6 people would also require 4 votes for a supermajority, and a full board of 7 would require 5 votes for a supermajority. On the following page, under non-discrimination policies, we changed some of the language in the non-discrimination policy to more accurately reflect what the legal protected statuses would be and reflect sort of federal law and state law on that front. It just simply says we don't discriminate in hiring practices, employment practices, or other practices as a result of any protected class and even some non-protected classes under federal law. On the next page, you'll see 3 red paragraphs. That's page 10 of 15 of your bylaws. The first one is employees. That provision is added as in order for us to get our D&O insurance, one of the requirements or one of the asks of the insurance companies is that we confirm that all our employees are at-will employees unless they're under a contract. So that language is added in there. At this point, your only employee is a contract employee, but to the extent you hire staff later, they would be at-will employees unless you had a contract. We added a provision regarding confidentiality of documents. That was a topic that was raised earlier, I think, by Senator Gates. And it just states that there are provisions in Florida law for private companies to keep some proprietary confidential business information or trade secrets outside of the public eye. And if a company intends to invoke those procedures, they have to give us written notice. And it states they would notify the board chair, the executive director, and the general counsel. Also, I think, Senator, a lot of the confidentiality provisions will be hashed out in any contract or award we work on down the line.
Mr. Speaker, to avoid any kind of entanglement of triumph in the politics of this issue, here's my question, Scott. This proposed amendment to the bylaws, does it provide that any entity receiving an award may invoke trade secrets as a way of protecting their performance from the scrutiny of this board?
No, it does not. It simply says, the law already says that trade secrets can be confidential if they invoke it properly under the law. We were just recognizing that statute in our bylaws.
So there's no narrowing of confidentiality.
No,
thank
sir.
You.
And I also think in the next section, public records, financial statements technically are exempt as well under public law.
Under public law, correct. The 8.07, the change is one we discussed earlier, and that's where the supermajority language is applicable. And that states, in the event a project or program arises that due to exigent or special circumstances cannot reasonably abide by the time constraints established by the board, an application for consideration of an award may be conducted outside the normal and established procedures and protocols upon a vote of a supermajority of the board. That's just intended to provide you additional flexibility if you have something that is ready to roll and doesn't need a pre-application process or any other pre-consideration before an application is filed. And then the final proposed change is simply changing the date and inserting the amended and restated bylaws on the final page of the bylaws and the signature blank for Ms. Skelton. And I'll be happy to answer questions about any of those, or they can be approved by the board in toto or in each one individually with a motion.
I have had the opportunity to review them along with Ms. Skelton, and they seem to be adequate in place. Any questions?
Mr.
Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I'll be happy to make the motion to approve the amendments to the bylaw as presented.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Dr. Dana seconds. Are there any more questions? Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, show the motion passes. Let's go to proposed public records policy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. At tab E in your binder is a proposed public records policy for Triumph. This is a policy that we created utilizing some of existing policies in the state of Florida. It is not intended to create any additional rights, but rather just reflect the state of the law and provide the Triumph board with the ability and some procedures on how to handle and manage public records requests as they come in, and to remind the board that we cannot require public records requests be in writing. So if you receive an oral request, you should direct it immediately to Ms. Skelton and write down as much information as you can about the request so we can respond to every public request for information that is possible. It also allows us to charge for public records requests and document duplication as provided by the statute. This is something that is largely we're proposing to put on the website to educate the public about how to make a public records request and what may be required of them if they do make one, but
any
not
questions?
To create
any
new rights.
Is there a motion to approve it? Is there a motion? Is there a second? Jason seconds it. Any questions on the proposed public records policy? Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Without objection, show the motion passes. Presentation of frequently asked questions document. I haven't looked at that very closely. Has anyone looked at it real close? I haven't. You want to, I mean, that doesn't require a motion. You know, Susan, just make sure it's clean.
Mr. Chair, I think Scott will speak to it, but we've been working on it. There are parts of that that apply to the application process that will have to be updated based on actions
right.
taken today. So it's for the public's benefit, and it's not really something that you
absolutely.
All need to
absolutely, but it needs to be accurate because we have done a few things today to sort of change that around a little bit. So perhaps that does not require a motion. If you could clean it up based upon the actions we've taken today, but let's get that disseminated as quickly as we can to board members within the next 5 days, and then put us on the clock, give us a couple days to go up or down, and then if no one has objections, then the modified frequently asked questions document would be sent out to everybody. Anyone have problems with that? Yes, ma'am.
If the board has additions or questions, where would they direct them? I assume to Scott, correct? Through email, or how would they make sure that they're whatever they need changed or included is included?
I mean, I think if a member has, if after you spend some time reviewing this document, if you have any other items you want to add, I would get with Scott Remington ASAP, because he's going to get with Susan and generate a document in 5 days. So I would suggest that, you know,
yes,
get with
sir.
Them.
Scott is holding the document right now,
right.
So best for him to take the input, and then we'll review it and get it back out to you.
Right. Status updates. Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The last things to bring before the board are that we have completed an application for directors and officers' liability and employment insurance. You previously have empowered Mr. Bentz to procure that coverage for you. So there's no action item for the board other than to say that with these changes to the bylaws, we can complete the application, and we're working with Chairman Bentz to complete that before your next meeting. The only other item to
try to get it to him within the week if you could, because I'm sure the agency or whomever is going to want to ask questions and all that sort of stuff.
Certainly.
Thank you.
And the final, we were asked to look into payment for prior administrative services. And our opinion at this point is that the board does have the discretion under the 2013 law and the 2017 law to make payments to the executive director for her pre-2013 Incorporation Services, as well as to the Burke and Blue Law Firm. However, we're waiting on one hopefully final opinion from Tallahassee on that fact.
And to follow up a little bit, the last thing we need to have is for the Auditor General to find fault with us on not just this, but anything. And that's why we've got the best CPA firm and the best law firm in Northwest Florida. If, in fact, the Auditor General's office said you should not have done that, we want to find out ahead of time. And I think that's prudent to do. I sure want to pay everybody. But if, in fact, they do determine that it should not have been paid, then they've got to pay the money back. So let's just wait until we hear more from the Auditor General's office. But that follows up. Does anyone have any objections to that? Okay. All right. So let's move on to...
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. One more thing. It is a requirement of Ms. Skelton's employment contract that there be an employment review committee that does her annual report, annual evaluation. And so we would recommend that the board appoint that committee now in order so that they can meet their end-of-year deadlines.
Any volunteers? Stan Connolly? Let's get two people on it. Is that enough? I'll volunteer for that one. So that's two of us. Good luck, Susan. Years ago, my partner and I did an evaluation on each other. And y'all know my partner, Charles Hilton. So he evaluated me, and I evaluated him, and I gave him like an 8, and he gave me like an 8.1. So we fussed at each other, 8! You know, and he said 8.1, so we agreed to never do that again. Okay, I'd have a little humor in there. Yes, ma'am. You want to continue on, Dr. Dana? Okay.
Yes, thank you, Chairman.
Yep.
So, Scott, on the agenda, we have a discussion of the scoring options. Do you want to address anything? Because we know that applicants will want to know how they're going to be evaluated or scored. So can you walk us through a little bit of the thinking on that?
Sure. With respect to the scoring process, the committee has been working on that. And the thoughts that we're considering, and if you're not on the committee and would like to have input in that, or if anyone in the public would like to have input, is whether or not it will be based on a strict numerical score for that element of the proposal, or whether it might be a range. In other words, you can grade things on a numerical basis, or you can grade them on an A, B, C, D range. Regardless of how they score, they still have to fit into all of the categories of the statute. So we're constrained to spend 40% equally divided among the counties. So the highest scoring projects won't necessarily be the ones that receive the awards. It's going to depend on available funds. It'll depend on geography. And it'll depend on how the project meets the different specified priorities and discretionary priorities. So I think that's in the next month. The board will try to come up with a rubric and then a scale, basically, for how these projects will be scored and whether that will be a specific numerical score out to a decimal point, to a whole number, or more of a grading system, a scoring in ranges.
Members, your thoughts? What does the committee say?
Well, I think Scott summed it up pretty well. You had a good, you were going to have an example of where two applications perhaps score identical.
Well, there's any number of scenarios we can anticipate, and it really demonstrates not necessarily how the scoring would work, but how the scoring would be differentiated. And if you can imagine two identical projects, one in a large population county, one in a small population county, that create the identical number of jobs, say they create 100 jobs that are the same ratio above the regional, you know, average household income, those may score exactly the same. But one in a less densely populated county you may feel has a bigger impact than the same number of jobs in a larger economic, you know, county with more opportunities. So those are the kinds of discretions and areas where this will get fuzzy and where you may even select one that scores lower than another project because of its location and because of the need to allocate funds to that county and the fact that it has a bigger impact on that aspect, that part of the region, with less additional opportunities in the future.
Mr. Speaker?
Yes, sir.
Since Dr. Dana has laid out two options and has not expressed a preference between a numerical and a ABCD grade, I sure would hate to get into the 8.0 versus 8.1, notwithstanding your comments. I would recommend an ABCD F rating system, giving us a little bit more flexibility and not getting into, well, am I an 8.1 or an 8.3, something like that.
Help me a little bit. Weren't we going to have our economic advisor help us with that system? But we want to give them a framework to work within, correct? Work within. Okay. Any thoughts, members?
Mr. Chairman. Bob?
This is going to be tough.
Steve? I like going the ABCD route. Just because if we get into something that scores an 87 and we like a project that's an 85, we get into arguments or discussions, but I was 2 points higher, why didn't I get funded, where it gives us some more discretion if we're evaluating two different B projects.
Well, remember, this is just one metric of many that we approve, so I'm okay with A, B, C, D. Are there any objections to that? I don't think we need a motion for that, do we? Would you prefer one, Counselor?
I think at this point you're waiting on a recommendation from the committee, but that's very helpful guidance for the committee to know
okay.
What the will of the board is.
You just got it. Well, we just received it. Keep going, Dr. Dana. You're on a roll.
Unless Scott has something to add, I think our committee report rests.
Excellent job. Y'all have spent a lot of time on this. It's well thought out. The questions today about this whole process were very good. I know now why there's business people on this committee. Some very sharp minds, except for mine.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Could I just make one more comment?
Yes, sir.
I certainly want to compliment Dr. Dana for leading that committee. One element we acknowledged multiple times is that the first application process and document we put together will not be perfect, and that at some point in time, probably in the near term, maybe after the first round of applications come in, there ought to be a moment at which we say, okay, what worked and what did we not have enough of? What did we ask too much about? Whatever those questions might be, and we just keep our eye on that and make it as efficient and as effective as we can on an ongoing basis.
And I echo Dr. Dana. As usual, you did a great job. I would also like to suggest that we have this April 15 pre-app deadline. April 15? November deadline. Still have yours on my mind. I would be cautious, folks, communities, ports, projects. Don't feel like the clock that all the money is going to run out if you don't make your application by this first deadline. As we said earlier, the bus will stop by many times. And I will tell you, the first tranche of money, in my personal opinion, we spend, I'm not inclined to spend a whole pile of money. I want us to get our training wheels on first. So don't feel a sense of urgency. Oh, I got to beat Okaloosa County or Bay County or Escambia County to the punch. I would be very patient. I would be deliberate, and I would have the information ready to go. But don't feel like there's a terrible sense of urgency. Easier said than done. Yeah, I understand that. But that would be my caution to everyone. Susan Skelton, update on the website agreement.
Good afternoon. At your last meeting, you authorized me to work with the 2K Web Group to establish an agreement for website management and maintenance. We have entered into that agreement. after a review of council, and the agreement is for a $400 a month on a month-to-month basis fee for them to service, maintain, and do any additions or corrections to the website as needed, and the agreement can be canceled or amended at any time. That's the report on the website agreement.
Good.
And Mr. Chair, my next item of business is a proposed agreement with Digital Boardwalk Incorporated. And after discussions with the IT security staff at Tipton Marler, it became clear to me that my original idea to just buy a product off the shelf and have that serve as our email and voicemail capture would not be sufficient. And the very nice people at Tipton Marler recommended that I speak with App River and Gulf Breeze. I reached out to App River and spoke with Beth McLean and described our unique configuration and security requirements and our need to conform with the Sunshine Law and the archiving and the secure server and backroom operations to support our current and future business model. And she noted that while their company could handle some of our needs, that Digital Boardwalk, Inc. of Pensacola would be a better fit for what we were asking for. And Beth and I met with Kathleen Shoup of Digital Boardwalk and explained our business security and archiving needs, discussed the importance of designing a scalable network solution due to the fact that we are not yet sure of the business model, i.e. how many users, where our office locations, the size of the office space, et cetera, might be. They took that information back, sifted through it, and designed a two-phase approach. Phase one would begin within a month and would provide secure archiving of email and voicemail records for members and staff, as well as a scalable platform for building a network and two laptop computers for staff. The document in your packet outlines that proposal, and it would be for $797.89 a month and an initial outset for equipment and training of $4,747.98. That would be for two laptop computers in anticipation of the board determining that they needed to add another staff person, then we would not have to go back and renegotiate for configuration of the second device. We would purchase this would purchase the licensing for the board and the staff and the two laptops. Phase two is more complex and not really able to be priced at this time since we don't know if or where the office space will be needed, and we're not presenting that proposal today. I'm recommending engagement of the Digital Boardwalk, Inc. to provide services and equipment described in the Phase 1 proposal that's in your packet. The proposal has been reviewed by Mr. Riggs and Mr. Remington for legal sufficiency, and Ms. Shoup from Digital Boardwalk is here to answer any technical questions if the board has any.
Members, are there any questions? Did you skip over how much Phase 1 costs, or did I not hear it?
Yes, sir. Phase one was the monthly proposal for the.
And how much?
It's $797.89 a month and an additional one-time charge of $4,747.98 for the purchase of the equipment and training.
You feel comfortable that's a reasonable price?
I do, because they're providing a service that we have to be able to have in order to capture and securely archive and for Sunshine and public records production purposes.
Okay. Members, any questions of Ms. Skelton? Is there a motion to approve?
Second.
Gates moves. Dana seconds. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, show the motion passes. You're still up.
Next, I was going to talk about the FAQ, but since we already did that, we don't have to do that again. As far as meeting dates, we are finalizing details for the November 8th meeting in Crawfordville, tentatively set for 1 p.m. at the Wakulla County Community Center in Crawfordville. And we're moving the December meeting to Friday, December 8th, in order to accommodate the Constitutional Revision Commission meeting that was to be held on December 13th. And we're planning for that meeting to be held at 10 o'clock in the morning at the Bay County Commission Chambers in Panama City. And details for both of those meetings will be provided by email and website once they're finalized. That's my report.
Okay, let's move on to the financial report. Steve Riggs, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first order of business we need to do is I need to make a motion. Basically, we are making a motion to adopt a resolution to get the appropriate signers on our account. So I would like to make a motion to approve the corporate resolution naming Alan Benz chair, Don Gates vice chair, Stephen Riggs treasurer as authorized signers on the Triumph Gulf Coast Inc. accounts at the First National Bank of Northwest Florida, and granting permission for one signer to execute expenditures for up to and including $10,000. All expenditures greater than $10,000 require two signatures. One authorized officer may make an internal transactions between accounts held at the bank. So that is my motion.
Steve, why don't you let me make that motion since you're on the statement?
Okay.
There's a motion. There's a motion. Is there a second? Bob Benezzi seconds. Questions? Sure you don't want to make that a million instead of 10,000?
That'd be nice.
You got to have some fun. Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, sure the motion passes. You're still up.
All right. Quick update on our Florida Prime account. So far year to date, we've earned about $1.1 million. This money has been transferred over to a trust fund with the DEO. Per statute. So that's it on Florida Prime. Any questions? Okay. I just want to let you know we do have a draft of our policies and procedures from an accounting and finance perspective. So I'm reviewing that draft, and at our next meeting we'll have something to approve. The other thing that we are continuing to look at is our budget. I have a draft budget I'm working with, and once we're still waiting on clarifying certain expenditures that we're going to need, but within the next month or so, within the next meeting or two, we'll have some sort of draft budget to work off of. So you can look forward to that interesting item. The application for our not-for-profit status with the IRS, getting an IRS determination letter. Right now we're working with our accounting firm, Tipton Marler, and legal counsel on determining which type of 501 we're going to qualify under. Once we do that, we will file for our IRS determination letter.
When can we have that done?
By next meeting.
Good. Okay.
All right. Travel reimbursements. I know we've had some questions on travel reimbursements. Right now we're working on coming up with form that meets Florida statute. So for the time being, if you have mileage or any other thing, just keep track of that. Once we get something and get it approved, then we'll get it out to you so you can file for travel reimbursements. And if you end up incurring any other expenditures, a hotel or anything else, just keep those invoices expense items, and we'll get that approved at a future date. I did sign two engagement letters, one for our auditing firm, which is Warren Averett, and one for our monthly accounting and payroll with Tipton Marler. So just to let you know, I did execute those engagement letters. And I have one more motion. We need to make a motion, and I make a motion to approve the financial statements provided by Tipton Marler for September 30th, 2017, and year to date. This is also in your packet. I believe it's on the left-hand side. But just to let you know, if you look at the financials, we have earned some interest. We have transferred that interest out to the DEO. And outside of staff and legal counsel, we've incurred a de minimis amount of expenditures.
We need to approve that, don't we? Is there a second? Okay, motion and a second. Any questions of Steve? Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, sure the motion passes.
Mr. Chair, I'm done.
All right. Public comment. Susan, do we have anyone who has signed up to, if you can possibly keep it to 3 minutes, we would sure be grateful.
Mr. Speaker, while we're waiting for that, may I just hand out a copy of a email from a member of the legislature?
I saw, yeah.
And I have copies for members of the public who may be interested. This was in response to a question which has arisen in general, not as to any specific proposal, but the question was, could Triumph funds be awarded for projects that exist on private property? And I inquired of Jay Trumbull, State Representative Jay Trumbull, who chaired the special committee appointed by the Speaker and was the prime sponsor of the amendments that amended the 2013 law. And you can see that he says, I wanted to follow up with you. I've reached out to House staff. They have confirmed that the Triumph Board is not prohibited from spending money on private property. And I would just like to ask, Mr. Speaker, that we refer this email, this guidance from the chairman of the House committee to our legal counsel for any review and comment they may have. This is simply provided as a matter of information.
Thank you. If you would review that. You can always count on the House to come through.
Senate silent, Mr. Speaker. House came through. I knew you'd say that, sir.
Okay, public comment. Michael Langston. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, and members of the committee. I wanted to quickly thank Dr. Dana and her committee for doing a fine job, and her work product improved at every stage of the game, including today's additions to it. I do have two recommendations I'd like you to consider. The first one is that you have a formal public input process. Allow the stakeholders in this room that have been here and others to actually give you formal responses to how they feel about the application and any improvements that you might offer. Usually that's done for a 30-day period. It's usually announced in the Florida Administrative Weekly on your website. And then you take those comments into consideration. And then at your next meeting, you could incorporate those comments you felt made sense. And then you could vote out the final product. I think you'll have a much better product if you do that. I mean, you do always accept public comments here, but it's hard to do it on the fly. That's a big piece of work that the public needs to really have a good input opportunity. So I hope you'll have a motion and take that in consideration. It won't affect your timeline if you essentially started it tomorrow for 30 days. By the November 8th, you could have the comments in and go forward. The other thought is that there was a lot of debate about the costs of grant preparation. I happen to know something about that because that's my business for 40 years. The Restore Council in New Orleans and the dealing with Pot 3 of the Restore funds and the U.S. Department of Treasury dealing with Pot 1, they in both instances allow what's considered pre-award costs, and one of the pre-award costs they allow is grant preparation. So what happens is somebody that puts in an application and engages a firm like mine or somebody else or just incurs it on staff costs, they're at risk. If you don't approve their grant, then they have to suck it up. But if you do approve their grant, it becomes part of the grant cost. It's reasonable, it's allowable, it's sensible, and it's a way in which you can do it. I don't think it's realistic to think hundreds and hundreds of small cities, counties, private entities are going to go to Pete Antonucci and have the Enterprise Foundation write all the grants. I love Pete. I've known him for many, many years. I used to, when I was in the legislature, deal with all the attorney general's legislation, and so I know him well, but it's not realistic, ladies and gentlemen. So consider that approach. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Chip Kirchenfeld. Chip, welcome.
Thank you, President. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Very good. I'd first like to start by thanking Dr. Dana and the application subcommittee for the work that they did. As a person who for 30 years has been writing and submitting grant applications to federal and state agencies, I think it's right on. It I think will meet the needs of the Triumph Board. Also, I have a question. I work with Escambia County. I'm the senior scientist and director of the Natural Resources Management Department. many of the projects that we are working on to ultimately submit to you for consideration, many of those are infrastructure projects. And I know on the first page of the application, the third bullet talks about public infrastructure projects. But there seems to be some question at the county level about what types of infrastructure projects you are really looking for. I mean, we have heard in past meetings, we've heard some of you say we're not looking for road paving projects, we're not looking to fill potholes, we're not looking for maybe typical stormwater projects. But what would be some of the infrastructure projects that you would like to see submitted? And maybe more importantly, what are some of the infrastructure projects that you really don't want to see submitted?
Council, I'll let you answer that question.
Well, infrastructure is a broad term, and I think the best guidance for someone right now is to look at the discretionary priorities that the board has established in the application. The statute gives them the board the leeway to establish discretionary priorities, and that's what the board came up with. And so the best guidance I can give you is to look at exactly what the board has indicated it's going to grant priority to proposals that meet those discretionary points. Other than that, the only advice would be to follow the guidance of the statute.
I think there's a key word that comes up at every meeting, and that's called transformational. I think that was the intent of your legislation in 2013, and I've heard all members talk about that. So I think when you're trying to figure out which projects will probably receive the best scrutiny, I'm not saying they all have to be transformational, but we sure want to make sure they, you know, we need that third leg on the stool here in Northwest Florida. So that would certainly be a consideration. If I've spoken out of turn, please let me know, members. Okay. Pastor Chester Davis, Port St. Joe. Pastor, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. To the speaker and to all the board members, I appreciate you for allowing me to come forth and speak for my community. I'm out of Port St. Joe, one of the first constitutional cities in the state of Florida. And I live in a community that's been blighted since the paper mill has went down. And we, in 2016, started to come up with a plan to revitalize our community. And we've been fighting really hard to make this section of Port St. Joe very visible to the public. It's been left alone. It's the buffer zone between all the industrial area and the city itself. And it's pretty much called North Port St. Joe because it's been left out of most of the rezoning and the revitalization area. So we're trying our best to bring economic development right back to our community. And based upon what the Trump Fund is doing, we are very excited because of some of the things that you have actually initiated and caused. We're hoping that you will consider us not necessarily taken away from the city itself nor the county, but because of this area has been the buffer zone between the two, and the industrial area is going to run right through that area. And when you come across that bridge, the first thing you see is North Port St. Joe. And we're hoping that you will consider us when we sit in application, not necessarily to fight against the city or the county, but that it'll help us to initiate some infrastructure so we can cause some greater density in our area and bring back an economic value that we had in that community for many, many years. The area is very, very historic, and we would hate to see it, you know, be lost. And we're hoping that the Triumph Fund would really consider us in the application. Not to say that, you know, we want to be different from anybody else, but we sometimes have to reach out and search things for ourselves, especially when you've been blighted for so many years. So with that, you know, like I say, I'm very excited based upon the fact that some of the improvement and amenities that you guys have looked at, and especially with the infrastructure, that it will be very important and very enlightening for helping us out. And I appreciate you that you will, you know, consider us when we apply for that. Thank you very much.
Pastor, thank you. I had the opportunity about 9 months ago to visit with President Robinson from FAMU, had lunch with him. It was, it might have been a year ago. It was before he was named interim president. And he spoke, he said exactly what you just said. You're a bit more eloquent, to be honest with you, but don't tell him I said that. But right. And I have driven that as I've gone to Port St. Joe. I've driven that area, and I understand what you're saying.
Okay, I appreciate that. One of the other things is that DuPont area was years ago one of the most profitable area in town. We had 32 business on one street.
Yeah.
And now some of them wasn't always legal, but we had, we had 32 business. Now we're trying to revitalize that, and we need your help and consideration. And I really appreciate it. Thank you all.
Jason, do you have any comments? Do you have any comments, Jason? Okay. Thank you, Pastor. Nathan Boyles, Okaloosa County Commissioner. Boy, you had a long trip over here, didn't you? Welcome.
We like it when you meet in Okaloosa County. If I may, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Goldman's going to assist me and pass out some homework for you.
Great.
These are a collection of comments from citizens of across Northwest Florida. Y'all have a good turnout at your meetings. I am a bit envious. My commission meetings are usually a bit less well attended. Y'all either have a lot of friends or a really big checkbook, or maybe it's both.
We have a lot of money.
That's right. I'll be brief. I have provided you a cover letter to a set of comments I've received from citizens across Northwest Florida. For the benefit of your audience today, I'll read that cover letter, and then I'll be finished with your time. On behalf of the more than 200,000 citizens of Okaloosa County, thank you for your service to our community. The decisions you will make will impact Northwest Florida for generations. They will not be easy decisions, and the best choices will assuredly be some of the toughest. To help you, I sought the collective wisdom of the citizens of Northwest Florida, only $1.5 billion entrusted to your care, and they spoke with a clear voice. Infrastructure ranked far and away as the single most important priority. Spending on infrastructure in whatever form is like investing in a CD. It may not be the hottest new thing, it may not promise spectacular short-term returns, and it certainly won't make your investment advisor the most money. However, infrastructure like a CD will unquestionably protect the money entrusted to your care. Infrastructure will guarantee a steady, consistent, and long-term return for the citizens of Northwest Florida. More importantly, no one can steal an interchange in the middle of the night. New roads don't lie about the number of high-paying jobs they plan on creating. Regional stormwater systems don't declare bankruptcy or walk away from promises and obligations. You are each wise and talented and successful individuals. But this isn't an episode of Shark Tank, and you're not spending Mark Cuban's money. Enclosed, you will find nearly 200 pages of comments from the citizens of Northwest Florida, the overwhelming majority of which insist that the funds entrusted to your care be used for transformational infrastructure projects. Comments came from across the panhandle and from individuals with diverse and varied backgrounds. One note read in part, "I see this not just from the perspective of a full-time resident, but from the perspective of a former government official who had to balance growth with common sense and making sure that growth resulted in a rising tide for all the boats, not just developers, merchants, and contractors. Growth that is not relative to the health of the body is the logic of cancer." The note was signed simply, "Mike Huckabee, Blue Mountain Beach." So don't take my word for it. Listen to all the citizens of Northwest Florida who took their time and energy to write you. And if you won't listen to them, at least listen to Mike. I have a hunch that he knows a thing or two about leadership and tough decisions. Again, thank you for your service.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate it. Jim Muller, Bay County. Welcome, Jim.
Good afternoon. Jim Muller, Bay County Restore Act Coordinator. First, I really want to thank the board for volunteering to serve on this board. It's going to be essential for the success of the region, and I know that everybody's invested in maybe more time than you thought it was going to be, but it's really critical, so I thank you for that. And also for opportunity to comment at each meeting, and also for Dr. Dana's committee and your work and listening to the comments that were made there, incorporating those too, is very much appreciated. There's been a lot of talk about wanting to get things done fast, and so I think it's appropriate to take a chunk of the money, try to get moving fast, and then in that time to focus on things that can bring immediate action and immediate results. But as we progress, and as Mr. Connolly said, is that we'll probably start reevaluating immediately and get that success there, but then think in terms of longer term, what's most important. So get that success there and then modify as necessary to broaden out the criteria as far as what we select. The other thing is that I would appreciate, I know we are moving very fast, but to provide meeting materials to the public ahead of the meeting, if possible, put it like even the day before on your website would help give the public time to review. A lot of us have dealt with this for decades, and I think we could offer something to help improve the process if we had a little bit more time. And then also I think at some point, if there could be a little bit more discussion on the legislative language about not supplanting and the discussions that I'd had when it was going, that was mainly targeted towards supplanting of legislative appropriations that may have come here and they said, oh, you got Triumph money, we're sending it someplace else. But then there's been discussion as far as local money and things like that. So I think a little bit more look at that, particularly in legislative intent, might be helpful. And then just a couple of general comments as far as the format of the document right now. We talk about putting attachments on, and I've dealt with both submitting and receiving these. And if you could do like an expandable PDF where the box expands according to the information, or making it a MS Word file to where you could actually fill in the space expands as you needed, rather than handling an application and 10 attachments for both the reviewers and the board, I think that would make it a less unwieldy process. And the other thing is that I really think that we need to make sure that the applicants that makes claims as to what they're going to do shouldn't be a checkoff box. They should have to have backup in terms of if data or analysis or at least rationale as to why this project is going to accomplish what they say it will. So I think that's important. And then the last thing is one of the comments was made is 4 is a supermajority of 6, and to me, that doesn't make sense because 4 is majority. You think supermajority is majority plus 1, so I would think that would be 5, but that's my view on it. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. Good points. Gary Hirsch or Hinsaw, United Way, Gary? Tell me how bad I butchered your name.
Well, my name is Corey Hinch, and I want to thank you all for the service that you're doing to our community.
I blew it good, didn't I?
Yeah, it's okay. Well, I am clearly the youngest person in the room, and I am the most ambitious. I'll point that out, too. So, again, thank you all for allowing me to come and speak before you. I just have a couple different questions and one recommendation. My recommendation is that we provide some of information what Gulf Coast Triumph does to institutions of higher learning. I went to a grant writing workshop at UWF, and each of them were scrounging around, scratching their heads with a much greater education than myself, wondering where they can get grant funding and train for various training and academic research that they do. Not any of them knew what Gulf Coast Triumph was, and I think this is an excellent resource. So I'd like to recommend that before the January, whenever this thing really picks up the ball again and goes on the next session where you'll be approving applications, that you look into marketing towards these institutions, because I think there's a lot of talent here in Northwest Florida and our academic communities, and they could really utilize and find help here. And my last question is, when will you decide who will be selected for your economic advisor and program administrator, and what are some of the qualifications you guys are looking for?
Next board meeting.
Next board meeting. Okay. I lied. I have one more question.
Am I correct, guys? Yeah. Yes. Next board meeting.
I'd like to make a recommendation rather than a question that this board submit and make available the grading rubric that you're suggesting before the 8th, the next meeting, and certainly before the 15th, so that we can base some of our decisions as people applied for this process before that time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Craig Barker, Northwest Florida State College. Thanks again for letting us be here, buddy.
Thank you.
And former Destin mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of Triumph Board. You should thank Dr. Stevenson here because he's the one that, and his staff that likely made that happen. Before I begin, I'd like to take a moment to let you know, as someone that has observed this process over the last year or so, just a month ago, I heard lots of comments from many of the attendees here that said they're 6 months away from even being close to validating the procedures that they need to move forward. And so I think it's a real testament that you have people that have done grants their entire life, like Jim and Mike and Chips and others, that stand up before you today and said, hey, you guys have made so much progress and we're, you know, think that you are absolutely ready and prepared almost to embark upon this process. So, Dr. Dana, you've just done a marvelous job. You and your subcommittee are to be commended. I did have a question on page 10 under approvals and authority item number 1. As it relates to eligibility, which are clearly defined at the beginning of the application process, the first words under approvals and authority item 1 is the governmental entity. Mr. Remington, I'm not a lawyer, but the last time I looked at Florida statutes, Northwest Florida State College is not defined as a governmental entity. Would we still be allowed as a college charter interstate statutes to have approval and authority as an eligible applicant?
You're an eligible applicant. Looking at that, we could probably phrase that a little bit different. I think that section is intended to say that if your project requires authority or approval from a governmental entity, you have that in hand or have a plan to get that prior to any funding being granted. Correct?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Remington, for that clarification. And also, as it relates to eligibility, I've heard several times today from the board in their discussion, for example, one example is to a private company that wishes to invoke the confidentiality requirements that are afforded under Florida statutes, they may wish to do so following the applicable procedures. That would then imply that private entities are eligible applicants. And so I'm trying to find out, could a Acme company that wishes to construct public infrastructure or otherwise apply for a Triumph grant, or must that applicant be a government entity or one of the other eligible applicants that are listed at the beginning of the application and in the statute?
Mayor Barker, in the statute it says that an awardee means a person, organization, or local government granted an award of funds as authorized in Section 288.8017 for a project or program. It doesn't specify it has to be a government entity. Anyone can apply. Whether or not their project would qualify is would be subject to other scrutiny, but it doesn't preclude any individual or private company from applying.
Okay. Well, you certainly answered my questions. Again, Dr. Dana, great job. Commend you. Thank you, board members.
We appreciate it. Anyone else like to speak? All right. Y'all race. First one that gets there gets to go first.
Go ahead.
State your name and address, please.
Good afternoon, Commissioner Doug Underhill from Escambia County. I'm the chairman of the Board of County Commissioners, 221 South Palafox,
welcome,
Pensacola, Florida. We'll use that address for these purposes. First of all, I need to start by saying, Senator Gates, I cannot tell you how pleased I was to hear you bake into the bread the sustainability concepts that Mr. Marone talked about in the strong cities. That is something that is amazing, the ripples throughout our community in Escambia County. Really applying and looking back at a lot of decisions made in the past, and had we made those decisions with sustainability at the forefront, as you have now baked into this, you know, would we be looking at these problems? Excellent move on your part. Thank you again for your continued leadership in the panhandle. The guidance that you put forth, Stan, that you made this the pre-application form a requirement. In doing so, you've actually given us as commissioners the first real guidance for how to do our part of this mission. And I think that while there are very few things where you'll find all commissioners in the panhandle agreeing on something, I think I could speak for every commissioner in the panhandle and say that we want to be value added to this process. We want to know what you need from us. When we check that box saying, does this have the support of the commission, we want to know what that means. And so I know that for myself, I'll be taken back to Escambia County. If I don't have at least the information that's taken out in this form, if you are not able to fill out this form and put it before the board, then I'll be recommending that my board not provide that check in that box until we've seen at least that level of information. So I'll say that that bit of guidance, as I was standing back here on both of those gentlemen, you just about got an amen out of me, because we are very, very much wanting to be value added to the process. Any more that you can do to guide us and tell us what you would want to be seeing, or more specifically, what you might not want to be seeing, those things will enable us at our step, before it comes to you, to be able to refine the process and bring to you things that are only that are more prepared for getting, you know, staying on that road to yes and avoiding those off ramps to no. So again, any guidance that you can give to the county commissioners, I think that the commissioners will be. I know that in Escambia County, we've talked about it extensively, looking for that guidance. It will help us help you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Pleasure.
And I would add, you know, just a reminder, we were formed at the end of June, had our first board meeting in July, and this is 3 months into it. My instincts tell me, President Gates, I don't think the government could move quite as fast. And we've come a long way. We have a long way to go, but we've covered some pretty sporty territory in the last 3 months. Yes, sir. Name and address.
Yes. I'm Gerald Wingate. I'm the vice president of city council for the city of Pensacola.
Welcome.
I've just got a few questions about the process that we're going through. Are all of the projects that come to the Triumph fund from all sources given equal benefit, or do you have to go get that checkbox from the county commission, or how's that going to work? We're submitting about 15 projects from the city of Pensacola. Escambia County requested that we put in 5, and I'm just wondering how this process is going to work. Are all 12 of ours going to be considered, or just the 5 that come from the county commissioners?
Scott?
I would say, Councilman Wingate, any proposal for which you apply, fill out an application, will be considered, mm-hmm. scored and considered. Mm-hmm. There is a special allocation for the counties, and that restriction would potentially come into effect for county-specific programs mm-hmm. that fall within that 5%, regardless of who proposes them. However, if you're not on the list that's submitted by the county commission, your project can still be considered and is still eligible for funding.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Councilman.
Hey, can I say one thing real quick?
Go ahead.
I've had that question posed to me a lot, but I will tell you, if you have a project that's a high priority and it's also a high priority for a county, that's a good thing. So I would definitely work with your counties and try to have their priorities be your priorities, because I think that will give it greater weight when we do get into evaluating these processes.
Good Mr. point. Speaker.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
Thank you. And I would like to just echo that. I've had that question a number of times, too. And there have been a couple of folks who have used the phrase legislative intent today. As Speaker Vance knows and Ms. Skelton knows, there is no such thing as legislative intent. There's the clear language of the statute. There's nobody in the world. Maybe there's somebody above the world, but nobody in the world who knows what 160 legislators' intent was and what the governor's intent was when he signed it. So legislative intent is an interesting phrase, but it means nothing, of course. The clear language of the statute, and I defer to counsel, but the clear language of the statute, I think, indicates that we should place weight on what the county commissions recommend to us. There's nothing in the statute, as I read it, that says that this board has to approve anything that county commissions recommend to us, but that would be an extreme approach. Instead, the clear language of the statute seems to me to say that the county commissions are available to us and are obligated by the statute to vet projects, to listen to what the entities within those counties recommend. But I plan, as one board member, to place great weight on what county commissions say is important. And I agree with Mr. Riggs that if there is an outstanding project that for one reason or another is not recommended by the county, I'll sure consider it. But to me it is a real plus, particularly given that we are obliged to make sure that 5% of these funds are spent in and for the benefit of each of the disproportionately affected counties. That's clear language of the statute. I'm going to pay a lot of attention to what county commissions say. That's why Commissioner Boyle's comments to us today I take very, very seriously, as well as Commissioner Underhill's comments. And so my hope is that the county commissions will help us prioritize. They're in a position to know, or at least to have a strong opinion, about what matters in their counties. Commissioner Boyle's made no secret of his view and the view of his constituents, and that matters to me. So while it's not an absolute necessity, I'm going to pay a lot of attention to what county commissioners say.
Agreed. Yes, sir. You're up.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My name is Austin Mao. I'm the executive director for the West Florida Regional Planning Council and the three transportation planning organizations in Northwest Florida, 36474 Emerald Coast Parkway, Destin, Florida. I appreciate you having me here. Appreciate you everything that you guys are doing. You have a big responsibility. I commend every one of you for the dedication and the hard work that you've done. I just want to reiterate and recap some of the conversations that have already been conducted today. If I didn't, I would be doing an injustice to my constituents that I have. We heard Kim talk about the Northwest Florida Forward Program. I am the chair of the Infrastructure Council. I would just agree with Commissioner Boyle's comments. That is the number one thing that we continue to see. Of course, I'm a little biased because that's my group, but we continue to see a severe need and a severe strangle on this region as it pertains to growth in the infrastructure department. Similar things happened back about 10 years ago in the Great Recession. Southern California, they developed a strategic group and said, what can we do to come out of this recession? What can we do to bolster our region? And they determined that investments in transportation, investments in infrastructure had the highest payoff. And when we do our REMI analysis, our economic impact analysis, we continue to find the same things. We can see that an investment into infrastructure has the ability to touch both residents and tourists. It touches both public and private. It has the ability to inject itself in a exponential return on investment that transforms an entire region. And when we look at our region, obviously the region is the body, the people are the heart, and the arteries are our infrastructure. And so we just want to again reiterate, please, if you would put a high priority on infrastructure, please put a high priority on the Northwest Florida Forward Program, and just appreciate all you do. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman. Anyone else like to speak? Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm Keith Wilkins, the Assistant City Administrator for the City of Pensacola, Office of the Mayor. Mayor Hayward couldn't make it today, but I would like to say a few words. First, in the Act where it talks about county commissioner or county commissions approving programs submitted by local governing boards, that put us in a little bit of a position because it didn't anticipate a strong mayor, an executive mayor, and so we definitely had our mayoral list. But last night, about 5:30, y'all may have felt the earth shake a little bit, and City Council and the Mayor of Pensacola actually unified on a list of projects and prioritization of those projects, and I'd like to thank Susan for that. She's the first one I talked to that said you're really looking for unity and partnerships, and I think that's what City Council and the Mayor accomplished last night. So I'd like to thank Councilman Wingate for his leadership on that, and also Commissioner Underhill for prompting the discussion. I think it was a very healthy one. I do have a couple of questions also. In the appendices, I guess, or the addendums, the types of projects are separated out. How would the scoring work
if you have projects that combine across a couple of those, workforce development and infrastructure project, if they mesh together, are those scored separately or?
Scott?
That's what we're continuing to refine. They will overall have one score, or that's the ideal, is that they'll have one score. Because there's so many different categories, we had to create the addendum to try to capture everything. But our goal is that each application will be viewed holistically and that it will come out with one score at the end.
Okay, great. Thank you. It's late, and I'll close there, except invite you to come to Pensacola and hold one of your meetings there. We'd love to have you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Anyone else like to speak? Okay. Stan?
Mr. Chairman, can I make a quick comment?
Absolutely.
A lot of great input and great comments on infrastructure today, as we've really heard it every time we've gotten together. I just want to provide some sense of caution to all of us and to you who are going to be making application. We're not the only entity in the state that funds infrastructure. And you're never going to be on a DOT priority list unless you go to DOT and ask, right? Same way for funds from here. So as we are working through this together over the next umpteen years, let's don't bias our decision-making on infrastructure requests just to this group. We could spend the $1.5 billion easily on infrastructure probably next year. We got to hold our other agencies and our delegation accountable. They have done a great job of bringing us this tool home to roost, so to speak. But there's other ways we get infrastructure funded. And I just want to caution us all that we don't need to ignore those in the interest of bringing your applications here and making them better.
Members, any more comments?
Jason. Chairman?
Yes, sir. You're recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I would agree with that. One of the things that Dr. Dana's committee has given us is really a mandate to look at leveraging this money and looking at other funding sources. And what Mr. Connolly has said is true. You know, it's right now we have a new Pensacola Bay Bridge under construction, and thanks to Speaker Weatherford and the governor, we were able to get $500 million to build that. Well, that's $500 million. It's an important bridge, but that's $500 million. That's a third of all of the money that we would have if we receive all of the funds that Triumph Gulf Coast has slated to receive under the settlement. And so a really good question to ask anybody who comes forward and says, build a bridge, build a highway, build an interchange, build some stormwater, sewers is, you know, have you been to the legislature? Have you been to DOT? Have you been to U.S. DOT? You know, let's pound away on those two new congressmen we got in Northwest Florida. And because we can't spend this all really quickly on two or three things. And so, therefore, leveraging this money is vitally important, particularly when it relates to infrastructure. You know, we got the 23rd Street flyover in Panama City. And, got some funding for that, but that's a lot of money. And you look at it and you say, well, it doesn't take, you know, a whole lot of city blocks, but it's a whole lot of money. And Speaker Benz knows because he got the money for the new Hathaway Bridge over there. I mean, it takes a lot of money to do one project. So let's look for partners. Don't just come to Triumph Gulf Coast as the only funding source. Look at us as maybe a junior partner in some of those projects.
And you will get DOT's attention, you know, if you were looking at a project that's on the five-year list. And, well, we can probably throw in X dollars of Triumph money. I'm making this all up. That might get their attention to move that up quicker on a list. Mm-hmm. Again, a lot of my criteria is going to be economic development transformation. I mean, that's going to be one of my top, personally, issues I look at. We need to do one last bit of housekeeping, and that is appoint the committee to find our economic advisor and program administrator. Scott, you for some reason did not like you thought it might be a conflict if the existing members of Dr. Dana's committee did that.
I don't think it's necessarily a conflict. It's a lot of work to put on a large committee already. I think that committee is four people at this point. But certainly it's not a conflict. It's just a function of workload and capacity with Susan.
Any volunteers? And I will too. You will too? Good. Great. That's one, two, three. And who's not on a committee? No, you can. Jason, I'd love for you to be on there. Great. Wonderful. Anybody else? More the merrier. Steve, you already chaired or did one. You're happy to join it. Sounds good. I don't think that requires, does that require a motion? Right, you're right. You're right. Okay, the committee's been appointed, and I'm going to suggest that President Gates chair that committee and set a meeting date, and let's get cranked if you have the time.
Yes, sir.
Okay, all right. Anything else, members? Stan?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to be sure we all walk away here with a little clear sense of timeline. I think I understand us to be saying that we're ready to open the pre-application process.
Next meeting.
At the next meeting?
That's the deadline for the pre-app next board meeting, correct?
Well, I think the issue is, Mr. Conley, at the next meeting we will have a team in place, hopefully, to score those pre-apps and administer those pre-apps.
But the deadline to submit, the first deadline to submit, you is at the next board meeting. We can move that, but that's what we talked about.
And I don't even know that we necessarily set a deadline, but we can take pre-apps now. They just won't be reviewed until the committee makes its recommendation, the board appoints the review committee.
Okay, all right.
I think that's just a clear point we want to walk away with. People out there need to hear is we're ready to start accepting those pre-applications to be screened once this committee's set up beginning at the next board meeting.
And we're moving lightning quick to set those committees up. I mean, we're moving as fast as we can move and be prudent and thoughtful about how we do it. Anything else, members? Well, we got a lot accomplished. I appreciate all your input. Long meeting. A lot of good things happened. We have a lot of work ahead of us. And I think Stan made a great point. For those of you that have heartache with the application process, I think as time goes on, it'll probably be changed. Nothing's cast in stone, but it's a great start and a great job, Dr. Dana. And committee. Meeting adjourned.